Even if we do something wrong, we know we're doing something wrong, don't we attempt to rationalize it in our own mind and to our friends to justify what we're doing? So I believe it's a great fallacy to set out to brand those whom we disagree with as being evil people. The result of their actions we may perceive to be evil. We may perceive it to be bad. But I guarantee you those people don't see it that way. And when we present ourselves to them in that light, we're good and they're evil, do you think we have a chance of getting them to listen to us? Not on your life.
So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday the 20th of May 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling, and thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, relentlessly gaslighting us with psychological warfare, propaganda. And what about medical misinformation? Great, this week we've been told that the World Health Organization is going to be able to mandate all over the world new health measures whenever it feels like it. That's if our politicians sign up. And the main point here is that we've got transmitters and printing presses, but who owns them? It's not journalists. So the next time you feel like having a go at journalists, don't, because they don't own transmitters, they don't own printing presses. Those are owned by managers, hedge funds, owners of the press. Anyway, navigating us through the Matrix, or whatever it is, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And joining us also this week is Lib Dem councillor here in Bristol for Brislington West, Andrew Varney. Part one, voters defeat the Bristol Mafia. That's what I say. Business West property speculators and the slave trading merchant venturers, who one of the bunch of people who really seem to be mourning the end of the mayor. The only thing is, we've got 70 councillors in this city, and we would rather that they had a little bit more say, and the mayor has been basically elbowing them out of the whole political process over the last 8 years or so. Also, Dr. Mark Jones looking at murder in UK care homes, what he believes is happening, or is rife with various people, largely solicitors and accountants, changing wills, taking property off people who are very vulnerable. And of course, we'll be talking about the cost of living crisis, what's really behind that. It's not just fuel and it's not just gas. In part two, the World Health Organization's pandemic treaty, an attempt to impose a kind of world government on the West. That is to say that we're, with the UN and the World Health Organization, setting policy. Governments basically relinquishing their own policy to the World Health Organization in the face of, oh no, monkey flu. Also, Alex Jones, the fake Bill Cooper, and David Icke, the fake Ivan Fraser. We have a look at how good the deep state is at running controlled opposition media. So, cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, Iranian and Russian news, now cancelled by the telecoms cartel, then Ofcom, along, but not cancelled here. You'll be hearing all sorts of things tonight you won't be hearing anywhere else. Almost like pirate radio here, isn't it? Anyway, welcome Andrew Varney from Brislington West, Lib Dems, to the show. Could you just tell us a little bit about your reason for being in the Lib Dems, joining the Lib Dems and becoming a councillor?
Well, for as long as I remember, I've always supported the Liberal Democrats, Liberal Party as it was in the 70s, and then various forms it took in the 80s and 90s, and ultimately the Liberal Democrats. And I think for me, when I was young, I just saw our election system and realised how unfair it was. You know, you get one party with a minority share of the vote, but a majority of the seats, and that's still ongoing. You know, in the most recent election, another very disproportionate election result, Boris Johnson's party got just over 40% of the popular vote, but they got an 80-seat majority and they were able to force through unpopular manifesto pledges. So, you know, I've always supported electoral reform. I've always supported constitutional reform. And that's why I've been a Liberal Democrat. But I actually didn't join the party and didn't become politically active until 2015, after the most disproportionate election result in history, when the Lib Dems were annihilated after the coalition. And I just thought, I need to put my money where my mouth is and join the party. Very quickly you get involved.
Didn't you take a look at the coalition and think, well, this is not for me, because the Lib Dems have sold out to the Tories largely?
Well, I don't accept that that point of view. I think actually what we did when we joined the coalition, we knew actually, if you look at reports at the time, that it was going to be very bad for the junior party in a coalition, but we did it for the benefit of the country. The country had had 13 years of Labour rule. It was time for change. Labour was exhausted. They didn't want to form a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And anyway, we didn't have the numbers to make it work. People voted for in larger numbers for the Tory party. So obviously they did have a right to try and form a government. If we hadn't joined a coalition, there would have been another election very quickly and the Tories would probably have got a majority at that point. So for 5 years, we had a coalition government. And, you know, I support proportional representation, which means very likely in the future, we will always have some form of coalition government. And I think, you know, we had 5 years of stable government. We made it work and we were able to nullify the excesses of the Tory party. And if you look at, you know, the country from 2010 to 2015, and then 2015 until now, very different countries, I think.
Martin, would you agree that the Lib Dems did the job in stopping the excesses of the Tories between 2010 and 2015 under Cameron and the Clegg coalition?
Well, I agree entirely with your reasons for constitutional reform and electoral reform. I've always been in favour of it. We, you know, the impasse in which British politics now finds itself is because we've got a system which is just not fit for purpose.
Correct.
You compare it to other comparable countries, all of our neighbours, and you can see what the difference
so
is.
So you're saying it makes it easier for special interests to get their way?
Basically, the first-past-the-post system was designed in the 18th century to keep Eton College people in power. And it does that perfectly. It's not a bug, it's a feature.
But, I mean, surely even if there were, you know, people could pay off two parties, control two parties.
No.
Not just one.
Listen, other parts of the of Europe have special interests trying to dominate policy, just as we do. But they have some defence in the sense that there's more opportunity for people to have different views and for that to come through in the way that politics is conducted. So I've got no problem with that at all. I don't think that you should, in my view, have gone into coalition with the Conservatives for your own sakes, as apart from anything else, because it confused, for example, a lot of Liberal Democrat voters in more rural areas who, basically, in many parts of the country, the Liberal Democrats are the natural opposition to the Conservatives. Just as a Labour of the natural opposition in other places. And in other places, it's Plaid Cymru
and
the SNP.
Andrew, do you think the Lib Dems are... And you're probably going to say yes to this, aren't you? Recovered from that coalition? Because a lot of people just thought, well, there's absolutely no point. These are just Tory light here, really.
I don't think my colleagues would appreciate being Tory light.
It's the voters that matter, though,
yeah,
and they might
absolutely.
Well think that,
well,
might.
I don't think so. I mean, I've been canvassing recently down in Tiverton and Honiton, where we have a by-election coming soon, the 23rd of June, important anniversary for some reason, and Brexit. And the messages I've got from people I spoke to are really positive. They're fed up with the Tory party. They're fed up with the sleaze. They're fed up with the lies. They can see that Liberal Democrats are hard-working community champions.
They'll vote for Labour then, won't they? If they're fed up with the Tories?
Not in certain locations.
No.
Have you been to Tiverton and Honiton? You know, in these sort of traditional communities, you know, you can stick a blue rosette on a donkey and they'll still get elected. But actually, from conversations I'm having with people, they are fed up with the Tory party. The Tory party is not what it was. I think the Tory party in 2010 is very, very different to the Tory party in 2022. And people are fed up with it. They're sick of it. They're sick of, you know, the ambulance waiting times. They're sick of being ignored. Lib Dems are community champions. We don't ignore people. We work for
them. Well, we heard an unbelievable story last meet. It was Jacob Rees-Mogg, bless him, our neighbour here, and the chairman of the Privy Council, which is all, you know, a whole other side of the constitution, which really does need disentangling. Or it is something serious doing about that. But they're the people, by the way, that have the right to oversee the accounts of the merchant venturers. Nobody else can. Journalists can't. Companies Act has nothing to do with them because they're constituted under a royal charter. But he announced this 90,000 cut in the civil service, which is almost unbelievable, isn't it? Let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions earlier this week, where some of the reasons why that is an absolutely insane idea come through.
Mr. Speaker, I know that I'm not alone in dealing with many constituents facing delays to renewing their passports and driving licences. In Girdling, there have been cases of family reunions in jeopardy and drivers nearly having job offers withdrawn because of delays to renewals. Can my right honourable friend assure me that everything is being done, that it's possible to be done in government to address this problem, so we can get the good folk of Godling back on the road and away for their holidays?
Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm told that the driving licences are now being issued faster than they were. No delays in successful online driving licence applications, and that customers should receive their licence within a few days. Now, if I'm misinformed about that, Mr. Speaker, I trust my honourable friend will let me know.
Well, it's not often that Boris actually gives himself a get-out in the answer. So he's saying, well, here is what's happening, but if it isn't happening... So what do you make of the whole idea of cutting all these civil servants and, you know, basically public services?
Well, you know, we hear on the news, you know, the people missing their holidays because there's a huge backlog at the passport office, and it doesn't seem like a good time to cut the number of civil servants. You know, countries going through massive changes right now. You know, Brexit really has only just begun. You know, there's a lot more work to be done with that. And, you know, to get rid of civil servants at this point just seems crazy. It's obviously a political move, isn't it? So, you know, I don't know what they're thinking.
Martin, what are they thinking? What is in Jacob Rees-Mogg's under his stovepipe hat?
Well, what's going on? I mean, you shouldn't be cutting public expenditure at this moment in the trade cycle. Yeah, you shouldn't do it. This was the problem with the coalition government.
Because we've just got inflation starting to tip up. How should that be addressed then? What's the best?
Well, a lot of that, we can come to inflation in a minute, okay?
Yeah, all right.
But you shouldn't cut public expenditure. I mean, they've been trying to cut public expenditure in Japan since the 1990s, and they've never succeeded, because every time you try and do it, the economy starts to go down, and that's what happened in this country, and then the deficit goes up. So Osborne, I said this to Nick Clegg after he was elected Deputy Prime Minister, because I interviewed him for this show. It was the week after he'd been elected. And I said, the policy you're going to pursue is going to lose the country's AAA credit rating. And he didn't understand what I was saying to him, which is, if you try and cut public expenditure in this situation, all that will happen is the economy will start to go down. And as it goes down, the deficit will increase. And so it transpired. And the country did lose its AAA credit rating, which was supposedly the basis of the whole policy.
Okay, so what should Keynes they be doing?
Keynes was a liberal. He didn't believe in the free market philosophy of how to run the economy.
We know that what they're doing is rubbish, is wrong. It's totally counterintuitive anyway. But what should they be doing?
Well, first of all, don't do anything stupid. Yeah, that's rule number one. There's no case for reducing public expenditure. It's what it is. It's almost like a kind of cult. If there's a problem with the economy, we've got to reduce public expenditure. It's like, do we? And it's not necessarily the case.
The result is going to be that people have potentially got less money to spend.
Well, that's right. You're taking demand out of the economy. Those 90,000 people will be put on universal credit, and they will not be able to spend the money that they previously spent. And of course, the jobs they're doing may also be crucial. You know, these are the key workers that everybody was cheering along 2 years ago.
There's even talk of a national strike over this, isn't there? From the Public and Commercial Services Union, PCS Union, have been talking about that. Absolutely horrified at this. And saying, well, what are you going to do? You're going to cut these people from the Nuclear Regulation Service, you know. And so what's going to happen then? You're going to have your nuclear power stations going out of control.
Of cuts of public expenditure, of civil servants, going back years, decades. I mean, there's nothing left to cut.
Anyway, I've given you your opportunity to say what they should do. Go on.
Well, it's very tricky because of the things that are to do with what's happening in Britain, and then you've got the global financial situation.
You don't know.
No, you don't do stupid stuff. No. You can't cut public expenditure because that will just make the deficit worse.
I mean,
the economy is going to go into recession.
For example,
if you cut public expenditure, you'll make it worse.
Would it help to up benefits? Because they haven't up benefits.
Yes, the obvious thing to do is to rebuild the tax base and help people on the lowest incomes by giving them benefit uptake. What you could do with universal credit is make it unconditional. And I receive universal credit even though I work because my rent's so high. And what you do but it makes me I don't want to work more than a certain number of hours because I lose money if I do. Whereas if I was just given the universal credit as a basic payment, universal basic income, then it becomes in my interest to take any hours I can
Isn't
get.
Isn't it interesting the way we keep hearing about the cost of living crisis, but nobody talks about rent, Martin? I know you recently had a hike in your rent.
So I'm in private rented and everybody's had their
rent. And what happens is the landlord comes along and says, right, well, I'm afraid we've got a big increase in rent as of next month. And if you say, oh, hang on, that's too much, they say, well, yeah, but there's a great big queue of people who want this place. So you're just going to have to pay it, or you know, there's someone waiting at the door to take over. So this is not a good situation. Now, I think in the UK it's 33%. In the US it's 40% of people's of average earnings is going on housing. That is to say mortgage repayments or rent. This is astronomical, even compared to things like gas costs or
But if you also compare it to what was like in the 1960s and 1970s, it's a very different... Yeah, and that's the decades of mismanagement of housing policy. I mean, we really are scraping the bottom of the barrel.
We've got Michael Hudson on in part two, so we'll be hearing him talking about some of the reasons why the Western economies have failed, because they can't compete internationally, because one of the basic reasons is rent. One of the very, very simple basic reasons. But anyway, back to Prime Minister's questions, and another reason why it seems to be a little bit batty to... cut civil servants at this minute.
Mr. Brendeshaw.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Home Office, Health and others now regularly take 6 months to respond to letters to ministers.
Yeah.
Immigration cases wait years to hear anything at all.
Yeah.
But instead of putting resources into fixing this unacceptable problem, the Prime Minister is choosing to fire thousands of civil servants and his ministers wander around Whitehall putting post-it notes on desks he thinks looks too empty. Will the Prime Minister personally look into this issue and instruct his ministers and civil servants to give our constituents the attention they deserve?
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
I thank him very much, but I have to say that, Mr. Speaker, I must respectfully disagree with the implication that for the civil service that working from home is everywhere as productive as being in the office and returning. And I simply don't accept that. I do think that we will become more productive and more efficient if, on the whole, we find ways to get back to our desks.
Erring quite a bit there, Martin. It does look as if much of the public service is at breaking point. It's falling apart. And is this just because people are still working from home?
No, it's not. I mean, what you've got to recognise is that there is now a power struggle going on within the Conservative Party. And people are manoeuvring to replace Boris Johnson. And in order to win in that power struggle, you've got to win over rather reactionary Conservative MPs and also 200,000 Conservative members, and they are even more reactionary than the MPs. So they're all these people are being thrown red meat. We're going to cut civil servants.
Well,
we're going to make them go back to work. They know that the civil servants are unlikely to vote for them.
We had this wizard scheme, didn't we, to send migrants over to Rwanda from the from Priti Patel. She's obviously looking at possibly wanting to take over. The only trouble is, of course, that it never happened, and it doesn't look like it is ever going to happen. And some are going to Jamaica, but most are not going to Jamaica.
Well, it may be, I've got a secret, may not be able to cut 90,000 civil servants either.
No, exactly. So much of this stuff that they seem to be floating appears to be just nonsense. Now, it's not to say that they can't... So they're saying, well, the law says we can't do... They can change the law if they want. They can pull out of a treaty if they want. This is the government we're talking about here. But no, they're not changing the law to make it possible for them to send migrants to Rwanda. They're just going, oh dear, well, we made that policy, but it doesn't work.
Well, you know, I've said for a long time that the Home Office is not fit for purpose. You know, you just hear these terrible miscarriages of justice all the time.
Wasn't it John Reid, even in the Blair era, said the same? I think it was in the noughties. The Home Secretary, and it's obviously not working.
I think a lot of the headlines we're getting, you know, sending people off to Rwanda and stopping boats from coming, using the Navy. I mean, it's just headline grabbing, isn't it? It's just a distraction technique from the big stories, the real stories, you know, the cost of living crisis and things like that. So it's just a classic technique, isn't it? I don't think there's ever any chance of sending anyone to Rwanda. It's going to be hugely expensive, hugely inefficient, and probably not not legal and very cruel. I'm not saying Rwanda's a bad place, but you know, people want to come here and we should deal with that issue, not send them off to somewhere else.
One wonders what these people are actually going to do when they get to Rwanda, or are we just going to pay them to be there?
Well, it's just a fantasy.
How are they going to fit in the economy?
It's a fantasy.
It's a largely rural country.
It's a fantasy.
They're all going to be farmers, are they?
A fantasy masquerading as a policy. Anyway, what about the fuel prices and the cost of living crisis? We'll be talking a little bit also about housing in a minute, because that is something I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about, and I'd just love to see something done about bringing that one of our major costs down. But that wasn't what was being discussed at Prime Minister's Question this week, with the Leader of the Opposition, Keir Starmer, questioning Prime Minister Boris Johnson over fuel prices.
So he's on the side of excess profits for oil and gas companies. We're on the side of working people, and there you have it. But he clearly doesn't like me pushing him on this. But the reason I keep coming back to this subject, and why it's so frustrating that he hasn't acted, is because so many people are living through this nightmare, and they feel totally abandoned by their government. This week, I spoke to Phoenix Halliwell. A rare kidney condition means Phoenix has to do dialysis from home 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. for 5 days a week, just so he can take his daughter Rosie to school. His dialysis is life-saving, so he can't turn it off. So even though his wife, who's a midwife in the NHS, works extra shifts, during the winter they had to turn their central heating off, and Phoenix skips meals to make ends meet. But their energy bill has still doubled. Phoenix says he feels like he's being priced out of existence. And it's not just him. Millions of our disabled, elderly and vulnerable neighbours are at the sharp end of this crisis. They simply can't afford to live with dignity. The decisions we make here matter. The cost of indecision is enormous. People across the country need action now. The plans are already there. The Prime Minister, stop the delay. Work with us to put them in place. Do it for households that face bills they can't afford. And do it for Phoenix, who simply can't afford to wait.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I'd be grateful if you could send me the details of the sad case, because the NHS does cover the costs of those who are on dialysis, Mr. Speaker. But if you send me, and by the way, of course, they voted against the vital investment in the NHS that this country needs. And I just remind him in the House of the key point. None of this is possible. The investment in the NHS isn't possible. The $22 billion that we've already put in isn't possible. The further investment that we're going to put in isn't possible without the strong economy that this government, this country, has delivered. And it's because we took the tough decisions that I have mentioned that we have record low unemployment. Record low for the last 50 years, Mr. Speaker. And this Queen's speech that we've been debating is about putting in the infrastructure, the skills, the technology that will continue to build the platform for growth and jobs in this country. And that is what this government is committed to doing, and that is the best way out of economic problems. And I thought it was fantastic, by the way, yesterday, to see Her Majesty the Queen open Crossrail. 72,000 jobs that has already delivered, $90 billion it will produce for the whole of the UK economy. Well, let me just ask the Right Honourable Gentleman, who was the Mayor of London when Crossrail was first started to be built, Mr. Speaker, and who was the Prime Minister who completed it, Mr. Speaker? We get the big things done, Mr. Speaker. There's never been a Labour government that left office with unemployment lower than when they began.
Martin?
Well, I mean, it's a very tendentious lot of twaddle, really, isn't it? Let's face it. I mean, the problems we are in are because of the austerity policies pursued, by Osborne, and I'm afraid by Vince Cable and others, which I think, you know, they should basically be honest enough to regret. The Labour Party's real problem is that it didn't regulate the city, and they didn't do anything about council housing in 13 years of Labour government, and of course that then led to a disillusion amongst Labour voters, and then therefore to the Corbyn insurgency. So, I mean, the real problems in the British economy go back decades, and they just haven't been addressed by anything that the Tories have done. I mean, the deregulation of the city, the privatisation of the energy sector, the privatisation of railways, these things are all wrong.
Well, yes, but of course, Labour did have its Blair and Brown era. Didn't do really anything to address it at all.
No, because what they were part of the Overton window mentality that they had is we can only do little tweaky things, we're never going to do anything drastic. And, you know, we were told, for example, there was no possibility of renationalising the railways, although effectively they have been renationalised because of the pandemic. Yeah. And at the same time, as soon as the banks collapsed, the money was no object. For either side.
Andrew, what do you think? Have you are any solutions to this?
Well, just to go back to the austerity point, I think, you know, if we're talking about honesty, I think Labour needs to be honest as well. You know, austerity policy started in 2008 under Blair and Gordon Brown. And actually it was Alistair Darling who famously said he's going to cut public services like Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, if we look at their manifesto in 2010, Labour actually proposed more cuts than Liberal Democrats. And under coalition, we actually cut public services by $1 billion less than Labour would have done if they had formed a government. So the idea that they are innocent is complete nonsense. I think we need to put that lie to bed.
I agree with that. That's right.
I wasn't expecting that.
I'm a member of the Labour Party. The problem is that they bought into this ideology of the free market. And in actual fact, and the Liberal Democrat Orange Book people like Steve Webb, he was in the Orange Book, and I actually was my MP at the time, said, why are you in that? He said, well, I'm trying to keep a sense of balance in it. But the free market philosophy of, you know, Hayek and Friedman and so on, which has been dominant in global politics since the 1980s, is simply wrong. The way that it describes how the economy works is simply wrong.
It seems to be funneling massive amount of wealth into the super rich who pay no tax.
It's the financialization of the economy, and we've got Hudson in the second hour, who's an American economist who discusses all of this. The financialization of the economy has made some people incredibly wealthy, but it's undermined the productive base of this country completely. I mean, we don't actually do industry anymore.
It seems to me
to a large extent.
That, for example, going back to talk about housing now, that we've got a lot of privatisation that's happened. I mean, for example, even in housing associations, the character of those has changed a lot. They've become more commercially minded. They're putting their rents up as much as they're allowed each year, pretty much now. we were discussing something last week, about the travellers. It'd be interesting to get your take on this, Andrew, is that we've got lots of people living in vans in Bristol. Is there anything going to happen about that? Because the council needs to understand that by living in a van, they're no longer claiming benefits and that sort of thing. So in a way, what they're doing is they're almost a relief valve for a problem that is not being dealt with.
Yeah, and I think the problem as well with this issue is that, you know, the council move people on, but they just move the problem elsewhere. You can't just keep pushing people from pillar to post. You need to deal with the issue. And I think there is a shortage of suitable sites for people. Obviously, we hear bad stories about fly tipping, excrement in bushes and things like that, and that needs to be addressed. But just simply moving people on.
Students do that as well, by the way.
Well, indeed.
The other thing, of course, is the official traveller site.
It's in Avonmouth, isn't it?
That's right.
It's not where people want to be.
I actually thought, this is a few years ago now, I thought it's going to have a good old look down. It was actually having a chat to the people that live there was immense pleasure. Fantastic bunch of people, lovely. But where they are is between a motorway, an incinerator, and a sewage works. There's quite a clear message being sent to these people that they are not wanted, they're not needed. In fact, almost untermensch, and we've now got this Priti Patel, was it Police Crime Courts and Evidence Bill? We had one of the QCs that's an expert on that speaking last week on that. It is criminalising gypsies and travellers. So this isn't just criminalising people who are desperate to find a way not to have to pay unpayable rents and to house themselves, but also these protected classes of people, travellers and gypsies.
Yeah, we simply do not have enough halting sites, and that's what we need to address. But, you know, I think, you know,
the council's got land, hasn't it?
Yes, exactly. But, you know, they probably want to use that land to, for more development that's going to be bring more money into the coffers. So it's always that decision, isn't it? Do we want to give land for van dwellers, for Gypsy Roma traveller people, or do we want to maximise our returns?
Amazing, really. And what I've done, because just to quickly mention Levellers Day tomorrow, I've been going on about this because we're going tomorrow to Burford in Oxfordshire. This is a celebration. Well, it's not really a celebration because there were three Leveller soldiers in the English Civil War executed against the wall of the church for mutiny against Oliver Cromwell. And this was the interesting part of the English Civil War after the execution of Charles I. Where many of the supporters of Cromwell were starting to think, well, hang on, maybe we've got just as bad a dictator in Cromwell as we had with Charles I. And as a part of that, I've written an article which is going to be popping up on the Landsdowne's website, hopefully, tomorrow morning. Which is looking at this, the contribution that rent makes to this cost of living crisis, and also looking, Martin, and you might be interested in this, at Michael Davitt and the Irish Land League in the 1880s and the way that they converted all these horrific rents in Ireland to ownership and built a new farmhouse on these what had been hovels before. And this was only because the Irish MPs held the balance of power at Westminster and they were able to prize these concessions out of the London government.
That's true. It was just the same with the crofting community in Scotland, because they were also in revolt at that time. And it's, you know, in theory, in Ireland today, you still, if you don't use land that you've got, it can, in theory, be confiscated and given to somebody who wants to use it.
They have lots and lots of smaller landowners, don't they? They used to be the old tenant farmers in the 1800s.
The peasant tenantry used to be, you know, they didn't own anything. They lived on land that was owned by others.
But of course, the English.
Well, a lot of them
back
were.
Back in the 1800s.
Yeah, but some of them were just local landowners.
Absentee landowners, most of them.
Boycott and so on. But of course, that's where boycott comes from.
Captain Boycott.
Because...
And Stuart Granger. See the film, I remember seeing that years ago. But anyway, just to try and bring some of this history back to today, fascinating report on ITV West about the military homes that are being left empty, 1,300 or so, empty, perfectly good, some of them detached, three-bedroom married quarters, been sitting around for years, sometimes up to 5 years, doing absolutely nothing, whilst politicians over in Trowbridge are getting rather fed up with all this.
Good evening. The leader of Wiltshire Council says it's a scandal that there are well over 1,000 empty military homes in the county, when more than 2,000 families are waiting for social housing in Wiltshire. The MOD says it needs a supply of empty properties so that service people can be moved at short notice. Karen Bell has this report.
Wiltshire, a hard place to get a home. When an empty council house comes up here in Chippenham, it can get more than 100 bids. In fact, Wiltshire Council's social housing waiting list has grown by a third in 2 years. The 5,000 properties it owns just aren't enough.
The MOD...
Which is why council leader Richard Clure has his eye on these spacious homes in Devizes. They're supposed to be for military families. The Ministry of Defence rents them from a private company. But no one has lived in these houses for 5 years, and they are the tip of an iceberg. There are empty military homes across Wiltshire.
There are about 1,350 empty MOD properties outside of the wire, so in civilian areas, inside the county. And those appear to have been empty for a long period of time. Now, that's a significant number when you look at our own housing demand. I have a housing waiting list of over 2,400 families. And yet, I've got 1,300 properties sitting empty in Wiltshire.
These Devizes homes have been empty so long that they're starting to fall into disrepair. Lynham is another place peppered with empty military houses. These ones have multiple bedrooms, large gardens, and are on a quiet street, ideal for families.
We asked the Ministry of Defence why they keep all these empty homes, and they told us that across the UK they keep enough empties to allow up to 16,000 service family moves every year. In other words, they want enough homes available to allow personnel to move if and when required. But they said they do try and get rid of the surplus homes where they can.
But that explanation doesn't wash with the council leader, himself a former army officer. He says the council has continually pressed the ministry to release the homes without success.
We've had a string of reasons. Apparently they're all under repair. Well, obviously they're not. They're needed for urgent deployment. Well, you don't urgently deploy troops into houses in the middle of devices. They're needed for rotation of MOD families. Again, these have been empty for 5 years. So honestly, we're not getting arguments that make sense from the MOD.
To try and meet housing demand, Wiltshire is building new houses instead, around 2,000 a year, often on greenfield land. And yet across this county, many of those much-needed homes are already here, standing empty. Karen Bell, ITV News.
Well, I love the army officer that's pulling apart everything that the army was saying and poo-pooing it all. But it is pretty shocking, isn't it? That's pretty much half their demand that they've got for these houses sitting empty.
Yeah, well, I said earlier the Home Office isn't fit for purpose. Maybe the MOD isn't fit for purpose either. I mean, they claim they need them, but they've been empty for years and they're falling into rack and ruin. That can't be a good thing. You know, if the MOD don't need them, like they probably need to do a serious housing stock audit, then get rid of them. You know, they're not doing it quickly enough. Although, having said that, down in RAF Locking in Weston-super-Mare, they did actually dispose of quite a few properties down there, and that's proved to be now a very popular location for families.
She was skirting around the name of the company, which I dug out as Amy, and it was actually originally a partnership with Amy and Carillion. And of course, we all know what happened to Carillion. They went bust about 4 or 5 years ago. So now it's all owned by Amy. I'm not sure if they're owned by Amy or they're owned by the MOD, probably managed by Amy. Let's guess. And what Amy seemed to be doing is basically using these as kind of land banks to speculate. There's money in the bank. So, if the property prices are going up, well, I'll tell you what, let's just hang on to these houses for a while they go up in price.
Yeah, land banking is a serious issue, isn't it? You know, we often hear that, people can't get a house, there's a lack of supply, we need to build on the green belt. But actually, there are the huge areas of land banking where, you know, if those could be released, we could actually build the houses we need.
Well, yeah, Martin, this seems to be a symptom here of privatisation. I mean, why can't the Ministry of Defence just manage these properties as they wish? They could sell them, build them, buy them.
I think there's another scandal, it may be related to this, about the MOD properties being basically run by private companies for profit. You know, this is the way in which, if you think of Centrica and all these other organisations which do what used to be done in-house by the public sector. And, of course, underlying all of this is the massive distortion of our housing market, where people from the 1920s onward have been encouraged to buy their own houses, buy tax breaks. You know, there's no capital gains tax on your houses. This, people say, well, that's great because it allows loads of people to buy houses. But what it does is it actually distorts the investment environment. So we've got loads of property price rises, and the economy depends on that. In Germany, when people sit around at middle class dinner parties, they don't discuss property prices; they discuss their business interests, and that's the difference.
Yeah. So the other aspect to all of this, of course, is we've now got inflation creeping up, Bank of England putting interest rates up. So whatever you were paying, folks, you're going to be paying even more now, even though you can of course, the background to all this, Martin, is the particularly in the public sector, the pay is not going up. So what that means is actually the pay is going down.
Yeah, real wages are declining, even though inflation is increasing.
So anyway, let's have a listen now to the question from Ian Blackford from the Scottish National Party in Westminster. About these latest inflation figures.
People didn't need to see this morning's official statistics to know that we're experiencing the highest inflation in 40 years. They know it because they're living with it. Mm-hmm. Families can't afford food. Yep. They can't pay their bills. And we're only at the beginning. And as always under the Tories, the poorest are punished the most. Yes. For months, people have been crying out for support, but month after month, a distracted Downing Street has failed to lift a finger to help. Yeah. Does the Prime Minister still support his Chancellor's insulting statement that acting now in this cost of living emergency would just be silly?
Shame. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I support the Chancellor's work in lifting the living wage by a record amount, Mr. Speaker, by making sure people on universal credit pay £1,000 less in tax, by making sure that we're by putting another £22 billion into supporting people with the cost of living, £9.1 billion already to help people with the cost of energy, and above all, I support what he has done to deliver a strong economic foundation which makes all that possible, Mr. Speaker.
Martin.
Well, I mean, that's just completely contrary to the reality.
No,
isn't it
is. It? I mean, there is no such thing as a strong economic foundation. This seems to me to be complete and utter bluster, Andrew.
Well, that's what Boris Johnson is famous for, isn't it? You just listen to him and it's complete nonsense. He just blusters his way through. He doesn't read his briefs. He doesn't know what's going on. He just coasts through. He wanted the job of Prime Minister, but didn't actually want to do the work of Prime Minister. I just find it very frustrating that we always have to drag the government kicking and screaming to do the right thing. You know, obviously the right thing here is to have a windfall tax on, you know, the energy giants. They've got this huge surplus of profits, unearned. You know, they weren't expecting it. You know, we could actually use this money to help the poorest in our society to manage their basic daily needs, but they won't do it. But they will do it eventually, but they have to be dragged kicking and screaming to do it.
If you look at the total for BP and Shell in the UK, because they've been announcing quarterly profits, it's now, Martin, 50 billion a year. They're in profit, not turnover, 50 billion profit. Now, that, of course, is a great boon for shareholders.
Yes, and of course, that may be the calculation that the Conservative government are making, is those shareholders are also their voters and their funders. So they've got to, you know, they've got to take that into account. Now, if you think back to the pre-Thatcher Tory party, you know, the Heath era or whatever, they would have just had a windfall
tax. But we see what we've got here is quite obvious to anyone with more than half a brain cell, is that this is profiteering. They're putting the prices up just for their shareholders' benefit. And there's no... I mean, France, obviously, they haven't been able to do this sort of thing because it's much more tightly regulated.
But it's also owned by the government.
It's a free-for-all.
So if they were making money, it would be going into the government's coffers.
So the actual fuel prices should be something like 25%, maybe 30%. This is in gas and in... petrol, diesel, less than they are, because that's actually what the market demands. But these people are in such a position now as an oligopoly that they can just price fix.
Yes, and of course that's why in the 1940s our grandparents were so wise as to put a lot of this stuff into the public sector.
Well, so maybe
and that's what they did in France. The Electricité de France is still owned by the French government. So Gazprom is still owned by the Russian government.
Shell and BP.
Well, yes, BP used to be owned by the British government. When they overthrew the government of Iran, BP was
had a golden share, didn't it? 51% or whatever it was.
I mean, these are strategic industries which do not function like a classical free market with everybody selling apples that are all the same. That's why it was not stupid to have these things run as public utilities.
There is something quite annoying about the oil companies, isn't there? I mean, not only all the pollution that they cause and the, you know, spillages and things like that, you know, the seagulls that can't fly because they're covered with oil, but it's just what they're basically doing is they're sticking a pipe into the ground and they're sitting back and watching the money roll in and playing golf and this sort of thing. Anyway, look, Boris Johnson did have something to say this week to one of the TV channels. I didn't manage to work out which TV channel this was about this. Well, this is his analysis, and we'll hear straight from you, Martin, afterwards what you make of Boris talking us through the cost of living crisis and what he's going to do about it.
I think everybody understands, and every morning I get up thinking, what are we going to do to help people get through this? Because it is going to be tough, and clearly the what's happened in Ukraine hasn't helped with the price of Putin's invasion hasn't helped with the price of energy, and we've got to manage it for people, and that means so for families, for people who are facing particular hardship, you've got to give them support. And that's what we'll do right now. But what you've also got to do is keep the economy moving, keep jobs growing, and keep our employment situation growing. Big difference between the economic problem we've got now and say in the 80s and the 90s. We had real misery of mass unemployment. That's not what we've got now.
Well, we haven't got it yet because we're not in recession yet, but we will be, and then unemployment will rise. What we've got is people in work who are worse off than people on benefits used to be in the 1980s.
So, Andrew, what do you think the Lib Dems at Westminster or anywhere else would do, should do about cost of living crisis?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, one of the key things we can do is to have a windfall tax. That was actually a Liberal Democrat idea first, and I'm pleased the Labour Party have decided to call for that as well. And I'm hopeful that the government will go down that route. It's the right thing to do. We can't carry on as we are.
So will they, do you think? Will they?
I think so. If we keep the pressure on, I think it's a possibility.
Will they do it?
Well, I think it's interesting that Rishi Sunak was the person who suggested that he was still thinking of doing it. Mm. Because, of course, he wants to preserve his reputation as being the ultra-Thatcherite Chancellor. So, but, of course, he also wants to be Prime Minister, and he also wants to win an election as a Prime Minister, and therefore he's a bit torn between his basic ideology, which is, you know, Thatcherite, and the fact that if you want to win elections, maybe, I mean, the obvious thing for the Tories to do, if they weren't having this internal struggle, is to snatch the Lib Dems Labour policy and then say, you don't have to vote for them to get it, vote for us. And they also then puts them in, they're moving towards the centre ground and all the rest of it. But the problem is that they've become a very ideological party. And they're struggling now for who is going to be, you know, who is going to take over from Lenin. You know, that's where they're at. And therefore, it's very hard for anybody to come out with a more moderate position because they're just going to be wiped out by the internal struggles that are going on, which have nothing to do with ordinary people. There's only 200,000 people in the Conservative Party, a tiny minority.
Anyway, also one of the reasons I asked you to come along, Andrew, is to talk a bit about the planning situation here in Bristol, because we've got these, we've just had this referendum, famously Bristol saying, with a reasonable majority, no, we don't like the mayor system, we want to go back to the old system, let's have 70 councillors making these decisions, and lots of brain power and input, and probably party squabbling going on to make those decisions, rather than just one man. And of course the problem is with centralising power is it makes it much easier for lobbyists. That's always, I think, the problem right around the world. If you've only got one man to talk to, then well, or woman, it makes it much easier for people who are special interests to get their way. Much more difficult when you've got to persuade 70 individual councillors from different parties to do it. Well, what do you make of the result, and why do you think Bristol voted to get rid of the mayor?
Well, I'm really delighted with the result. Obviously, it was a key plank of our manifesto. We all stood on our platform to scrap the mayor, and we delivered it. It was a cross-party effort. Immediately after the local elections last year, we started talks with the Greens, with the Conservatives, and we got a position that we were happy with. We put our motion forward in December, and that got unanimous or virtually unanimous opposition support. The rest is history. So people had their say after 10 years of the mayoral failure, and I think the result was pretty conclusive.
So what do you think main reasons people voted against the mayor system were?
I think talking to people on the doorsteps, people mentioned the fact, the lack of democracy in the system. So you have one person making decisions behind closed doors, often with advisors, often with, you know, people from the business world with their feet under the table, they're not elected, they're not held to account. These decisions were not being scrutinised. You know, we have scrutiny commissions, but very often, by the time they got the reports, it's already a done deal. I think people are fed up with that. They want their decision making to be transparent. So I think that was one of the principal reasons, actually. And the other reason, of course, is the amount of waste. So you had one person making decisions surrounded by yes people who are afraid to say, actually, that's not a good decision. And if they did say that, they'd be kicked out. You know, the classic example is of course, Bristol Energy, you know, where millions of pounds of our money was pumped into supporting a company that was never going to make a profit. And we were saying that from 2016 onwards. But yet, you know, the mayor was saying it was a viable company. I think he said it was a viable company right up to the month before they decided to set it off. So, you know, that was ridiculous, and that would never have happened under a committee system if decisions could be made.
But am I right in thinking that Bristol City Council didn't sell off the debt? They still carry the debt. I mean, this is so they sold it off as a going concern to someone who would not take on the debt. It's the 50 million debt. It's a lot of money. Well, I don't know if that's exactly what the company is owing, But it's a lot of public money to spend on what was a pet project that just wasn't thought through.
It is a lot of money, and we can't afford to waste that money, as we know. And that's
how
why
many
we need
schools would £50 million build, I wonder? How many public toilets?
Indeed.
How many?
Well, there are no public toilets anymore, are there? So, yeah. It's just the waste. I think that was really probably the key issue for most people. It was just the waste. In fact, that we were unable to stop the waste. And that's why people voted for change. And also, you know, Bristol is not a one-party state. Mm. Bristol is a pluralist city. We have, you know, same number of Green councillors as Labour councillors, Conservatives and Liberal Democrats. You know, people don't just want one party making all decisions.
The Greens are eating into the Labour vote here. So I'm surprised that the Greens supported you, because it's quite feasible the next mayor might be Green.
Well, actually, it's quite interesting.
If they left the system,
I think if the mayor had been slightly more collegiate after the last election and let some Green councillors into his cabinet, then perhaps we could have avoided the referendum altogether, because I don't think the Greens would have gone for it if they had got their, you know, seats in cabinet. But
and what about the Conservatives? Because they, although they opposed the mayor, they were very much for the idea. Back in whenever it was 2012, was it, when we voted to have a mayor? The Tories of old, they'd done a bit of a switch and a swerve on that one.
Absolutely. I mean, it was their policy to begin with, wasn't it? It was George Osborne and David Cameron. They got all the cities together and said, look, we're going to give you loads of extra funding.
And Nick Clegg, the Lib Dem, come on.
They said, you know, they promised lots of extra funding and regular
bribes.
Sort of,
bribes, come on.
regular sessions at Downing Street, you know, feet at get yourself into top table. But, you know, Bristol was the only city that actually voted to have the directly elected mayoral system, and that funding failed to materialise. So it was just a costly, extra, unnecessary layer of local government we couldn't afford.
But we've got 2 years now until the next election, where the system will change and the mayor will no longer have the massive amount of power and control over pretty much everything that he does now. In that meantime, isn't it likely that we're seeing one of the main contentious aspects of the mayor, the Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor that's been around for the last, seven years, I think, is the enormous increase in the number of massive developments that have been going on in the city and proposals for things which would have been thought horrific and awful, never been allowed before, are now springing up, these basically like massive square boxes, office buildings in places which just they shouldn't be, like Castle Park. It's overshadowing the park, so people are lying in the park on the grass, but no, there's actually a giant tower block towering over them, blocking out the sun, and they look ugly, these things. And so because I understand that the spatial strategy, which is something that the city planners use in order to say to developers, well, look, we would rather you built there and not there, has basically just fallen through the floor. It wasn't accepted, and there is no spatial strategy. So one of the main tools that the council can use to hold back unsightly, inappropriate developments, speculative developments, if actually that's what these things are, just make someone making money, that's gone.
Yeah, in fact, it's just been appalling, really. The spatial strategy, obviously, is a WECA obligation.
The Metro Mayor.
The West of England Combined Authority, which is headed by the Metro Mayor, Dan Norris, who's from the Labour Party. But, you know, it's not the first time it's failed. It failed before under the previous Metro Mayor. And basically, it was thrown out by central government as being not fit for purpose. You know, basically, lots of decisions about where housing development would go were unsound decisions. They were not robust.
Let me suggest why this might be. And that is because the speculator developer friends of the mayor's office, both with the previous Tim Bowles, the previous Metro Mayor, and maybe with Dan Norris too, they are getting their way. They say, well, we want it written like this, rather than the Metro Mayor's pushing back and saying, no, let's talk to communities, let's, you know, decide in a more democratic fashion whereabouts is the most appropriate place for development to happen.
Well, that's the advantage of the committee system, isn't it? All the decision making would be made in public, and there'd be public involvement. Everyone would have their say. No decision would be made in private. And that seems to be the problem we've had with the spatial plan previously. You know, it was basically a bit of a stitch up between various leaders. And as I say, it wasn't accepted by central governments, had to go back to the drawing board. And it seems so they haven't learnt their lessons. So it seems as though once again, we've got personalities causing problems. The mayor seems to have fallen out with the leader of South Gloucestershire. It's a very unedifying spectacle, really. And, you know, meanwhile, we're all going to suffer, and perhaps our Greenbelt is going to suffer.
Which mayor has fallen out with the leader of South Gloucestershire? Because we've got we've got a Lord Mayor too, but let's not confuse things. Which mayor has fallen out with?
So, obviously, as part of the WECA process design a spatial plan,
Dan Norris
doesn't seem to be have a very good working relationship with one of the unitary authority leaders.
So depressing.
It is depressing.
Yeah. But anyway, so one of the other things which is going on right now is I thought we'd have a listen to the way that this thing is done at the Bristol City Council. I understand you're on one of the planning committees, are you?
I am, yeah.
Yeah. How does it work, basically?
So basically, we get a series of developments. Normally, they're big developments or they're developments that have got a lot of local opposition.
So it's not somebody doing a kind of a gazebo in the garden or something? No.
That would be very unlikely unless hundreds of people objected to it. And the other way, the local council, if they call it in and then it comes to committee. So obviously, a lot of most planning applications are not seen by the committee. They're decided under delegated
By the planning powers.
By the planning officers. So we tend to get the more controversial ones coming in front
Big
of
ones.
Us.
Yeah. Money-making ones. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the very exciting Bristol City Council Development Control Committee as they explain how, although one of the plans which was put in near Templemead Station here in Bristol was thrown out because they said there's actually too dangerous a flood risk around there, strings have been pulled and the rest is history.
Interest sort of citywide, really, albeit this was a decision made some time ago by the DCA committee. Members may well be aware of the proposals at Silverthorne Lane in Temple Quarter, a mix of housing, employment space, student accommodation, and also a new secondary school. The committee, in line with officer recommendation, had recommended approval. But in this case, because the Environment Agency had a holding objection in terms of flooding, the application was called in by the Secretary of State. And so that process took up a large part of last year and some of this year as well, waiting for the decision following that. And I'm glad to say that it says appeal allowed, but it wasn't an appeal, it was just an application recovered by the Secretary of State. But following the report of the planning inspector, the Secretary of State, or in this case it was the planning minister, has decided to grant permission for the development.
So anybody having problems going to sleep, I would suggest you get recordings of the Development Control Committee and play them. But anyway, the point here, I suppose, is that the massive amounts of money can be made in planning and development, Andrew, can't they?
Yes, I mean, most developers are not in it for the good of their health. They want to make some money, absolutely. But that's the same with all walks of life, isn't it? But the Silverthorne Lane is an interesting one. I personally would like to see development on, you know, in the St. Philip's Marsh area. You know, it's close to the city centre. It does seem like a really good, sustainable location. But obviously, you need to sort out the flood risk problem. I think, you know, with modern building methods, you can. If you look at the paintworks in Brissenden West, my own ward, those buildings are elevated. So on the ground level, you've got car parking, and then housing is higher up, and that sort of deals with the flood risk problem.
I can remember looking at Canesham, I think it was, the old chocolate factory, where the original plans went in there for loads of housing on the floodplain. And then, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, we were driving past when there was floods. And a friend who was a Bristol Post photographer, a taxi driver, and I said to him, look, come and have a look at this. There's this planning application in at the moment. And you could get a photo. And then the next day it was on the front page of the Bristol Post saying, look, they're about to build houses here, and showing just how high the floodwaters came up around that part of the Avon Valley, I suppose it is. But anyway, this also came up in Prime Minister's questions this week, the whole issue of planning.
Andy Carter.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Yeah. Earlier this week, the planning inspectorate waved through a decision by Labour councillors to build a massive logistics hub in South Warrington. The plans are contrary to national policy, entirely in the Greenbelt, and have been approved despite more than 1,000 letters of objection. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that listening to local communities and protecting our precious Greenbelt must be at the heart of planning policy? And will he meet with me to see how local residents can have their voices heard?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, local residents could have no more powerful voice than that of my my honourable friend. The House will have heard him loud and clear. I know the Ministry, Department of Levelling Up, will have heard him loud and clear. I will make sure that he gets the relevant meeting.
Thousands of objections ignored. Does that sound familiar?
Well, you know, I'm on the planning committee and I do not ignore objections. You know, you read all the public statements and that informs your decision.
The planning officers are also, they try and twist your arm too, though, don't they?
No.
No?
No. you might think that I couldn't possibly comment.
But there is, as I say, Martin, there's an enormous amount of pressure here. And I think there's a perception anyway, whether it's true or not, it'd be interesting. We can ask Andrew in a minute. But when we've got the mayor around for 2 years, there are people, a lot of people are thinking, well, maybe these developers and speculators will try and squeeze a lot of that planning and development through before the mayor system goes.
Or it may be that Marvin just becomes a lame duck, which is the other possibility. The Chesham and Amersham by-election was very significant in this, because the property developers are they provide 40% of the Tory party's funds, so they're very big players in terms of internal Tory politics. But of course, what they want is on a collision course with what suburban Tory voters want in places like Amersham and Chesham. And the Liberal Democrats, partly of course because it was a Remain voting seat, it made it much easier for you to take. But of course, what's interesting from your point of view, coming up with the Tiverton by-election, is what happened in North Shropshire, because that was a Leave voting Conservative seat.
Indeed. Yes, I think for a lot of people, Brexit isn't such a key issue anymore. It is the cost of living crisis. It is the NHS waiting times, and they feel as though the Conservatives are ignoring them in these, especially in farming communities as well. You know, farmers have been hung out to dry. So people are changing. People are seeing the Liberal Democrats as a viable alternative in these sort of blue wall seats. So you know, the Liberal Democrats, I think, you know, with the next election probably coming up next year, maybe the year after, who knows, but the Liberal Democrats, if they can concentrate on those blue wall seats and Labour can concentrate on the red wall seats, we stand a chance of getting rid of this awful Tory government.
I would be in favour of formal coalition talks, you know, but you can see that Starmer is not willing to go there. He's from the Labour machine tradition. And of course, when Corbyn was elected Labour leader, I questioned him when he wanted to be Labour leader in a meeting in Bristol, saying, will you commit to PR? Because that's the key thing. If you want to push forward your radical socialist policies, if you commit to PR as well, then you can get a hearing and you can build coalitions around.
Maybe he doesn't want radical socialist policies.
Well, no, I think what it is they're just stuck in the mud. Yeah, will not, because of the tradition of that they have. And I've been a member of the Labour Party since 1975, so I'm part of this, but I've always been in favour of electoral reform.
They came very close last year, didn't it, the Labour Party conference, and it was the union bloc voting that prevented it from going through. But I think actually a lot of the unions are now changing their minds. So if we try again, I think it could become Labour Party policy, which would be a great breakthrough.
It would. I mean, obviously what's happened at local level is I can't remember, the Labour Party has submitted, constituency has submitted a motion to this year's conference saying only Stand to Win, so that each local constituency Labour Party would make a decision whether to stand a candidate or not, depending on local conditions. So in Tiverton, they might, for example, decide not to stand a candidate.
But I believe it's Labour Party policy at the moment to fight everything.
That's right, because it goes back to the 1900s, when the Labour Party was a very young party. And the idea was that everybody anywhere in the country should be able to vote Labour as a basically a protest vote.
I actually think the Tories,
that's the history of it.
With a Lib Dem Labour electoral pact like that, I think actually the Tories would be quaking in their boots.
That's right, they're terrified of it. That's an obvious thing for us to take into account, isn't it?
One of the other spin-offs from having a mayor here in Bristol is that there is this kind of network of mayors from around the world who are working very closely with groups like the World Economic Forum. Now, they are apparently having one of their... their main meeting, I think, at Davos every year is in January, but they have a sort of, kind of late spring, early summer meeting too. Before we hear about the most recent Davos meeting of the World Economic Forum, here is Greg Rees from the United States looking at these networks of mayors around the world that are actually pushing for what he believes is pushing for, anyway, international control of policy and effectively a kind of world government through the private network called the World Economic Forum.
In Geneva, Switzerland, members of the World Health Organization, which was founded on the principles of establishing a one-world government, will be voting to give themselves worldwide authority when it comes to official international health emergencies. The same World Health Organization who praised Communist China's extreme authoritarian lockdown against the Chinese people, who suggested forcibly separating families to quarantine them.
In most parts of the world, due to lockdown, most of the transmission that's actually happening in many countries now is happening in the household, at family level. In some senses, transmission has been taken off the streets and pushed back into family units. Now we need to go and look in families to find those people who may be sick and remove them and isolate them in a safe and dignified manner.
And who was caught faking the H1N1 pandemic in 2010. The same World Health Organization run by Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who's been working with the Clinton Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation since 2007, who said that the lockdowns will never end.
I repeat, there will be no return to the old normal for the foreseeable future.
And that the war in Ukraine was getting massive attention as a result of bias against black lives. The U.S. government is in full support of this new UN treaty with the WHO and has submitted 13 amendments, which will be voted on next week, that will give the WHO international authority on lockdowns, forced quarantines, and forced vaccinations. According to constitutional lawyer Robert Barnes, none of this is legally binding until a treaty is approved by the U.S. Senate. But the law hasn't been stopping these criminals from committing crimes against humanity so far. And if they plan on staying in power, they are going to have to bring back the lockdowns and the ballot harvesting mules. So we know it's coming, and it will soon be climate lockdowns to go with their climate migration. People are waking up, but the UN's agenda is aggressively pressing forward. The United Nations is meeting this week with members of the Mayor's Migration Council, which is comprised of 9 mayors from 9 different cities throughout the world, including Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles, California. The Mayor's Migration Council is funded by George Soros's Open Society Foundations, sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation, and partnered with the United Nations. And their stated goal is pretty clear. They want to grant mayors the ability to bypass state and federal government when it comes to what they call climate migration and go straight to international organizations for resources. They are inviting all interested mayors or senior city staff members to contact them at contact@mayorsmigrationcouncil.org to learn how to engage with the international system and learn how to get funding and boots on the ground support. This all sounds completely illegal, but who's going to stop them? There is no longer any justice in America, so expect more lockdowns as the food supply diminishes and the population around you surges with hungry foreign migrants. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Rees.
So, yes, this is rather a nasty little thing at the end there about lots of foreign migrants will be trying to eat your food as the food shortages kick in. But he does have a point, Greg Rees, at InfoWars there, Andrew, in that there are these networks of mayors around the world. Actually, it turns out, and I didn't realise this when I first listened to that clip, that Marvin Rees is on this group, the World Migration, Mayors Migration Council. And all these sort of NGOs are being privately funded, but they're actually making these political decisions.
Well, it's a good idea. Good luck. No, good job. We're getting rid of our elected mayor then, isn't it? So hopefully he won't be able to pursue this campaign.
I think it's an interesting concept that although you've got someone who's elected for Bristol, that they're actually almost bypassing the normal kind of diplomatic arrangements for coming up with policies. I mean, I don't think they're signing any treaties here. And also, of course, this is all Martin. This is all things, for example, Rockefeller funded, the Rockefeller Foundation. These tax exempt foundations are taking a role over where governments are saying, well, actually, we haven't really got the cash to do this kind of thing. You guys get on with it. The World Economic Forum is another one.
Well, the World Health Organization was originally supposedly a public sector body with, you know, various countries being members of it. But because particularly the US have refused to fund their bit of it, then, of course, you get philanthropists.
Oh, hang on. It's not just the US, is it? Because the UN, these UN bodies have been underfunded for decades.
Trump took the US out of the WHO.
But the point is that these private bodies have been funding the UN. In fact, I think 2019.
Well, that was what I was going to say. What's happened is in principle, the World Health Organization is a public sector body made up of government appointees. But because they have this idea of public-private partnership, we haven't got enough money. But, oh, look, here comes Bill Gates, here comes George Soros. They're going to give us some money. And then, of course, this is where you've got this whole idea. Now, I think that things that are public should be public and things that are private should be private. And there's a reason for that, because public bodies have a different set of priorities than private bodies, however philanthropic. Yeah? Bill Gates should pay his taxes. All of them, and then we'll spend the money that we get off.
I think the Gates Foundation should be taxed, you know, because
idea of foundations is a way to avoid paying tax. But of course, you can then use them to push your agenda, whatever it is. Sheldon Adelson isn't mentioned there. He's the biggest contributor to US politics, and he's an extreme right-wing Republican, pro-Israeli, who said, why don't we nuke Iran? But we don't hear about him. We hear about Soros and we hear about Gates because they've got some kind of liberal credentials. So the sort of right-wing commentator on InfoWars doesn't like them, and he doesn't like their money. But of course, they don't mention all the right-wing billionaires because they fund InfoWars.
Do they?
Well, I think they probably do. Yes.
Look at
somebody like Alex Jones, who set up InfoWars. He's a millionaire, like most people in the US who are involved in politics.
But I don't know if it's funded. I think they fund themselves nowadays, don't they?
Advertising. The point is you need enough money to become viable on that basis. And, of course, it is true that, the WHO has been captured by special interests, pharmaceutical companies and so on.
Well, it's the World Economic Forum meeting this weekend, but almost more interestingly, what we don't hear much about is, 22nd to the 26th of May. So there'll probably be some stuff about that next week, maybe on the news, but I bet there'll just be... I mean, it does frustrate me because it's like, oh, these great super rich philanthropists have got such wise words. No, quiz them, cross-examine them. Every single move they make, because they're predating on our democratic system systems around the world. But the obvious thing to talk about is the Bilderbergers. I mean, it's this time of year the Bilderberg meetings happen. Nothing whatsoever on their page, Martin. They seem to have disappeared off the face of the earth, apparently. And yet, both with the war in Ukraine and the pandemic, there were literally hundreds of Bilderbergers and ex-Bilderbergers involved in both of those.
Well, elite groups have their various clubs in which power is bartered and changed. You know, you've got the gentlemen's clubs in the City of London. You know that you've got the Bullingdon Club at Oxford University. You've got Skull and Bones at Yale. You've got Bilderberg Group, which was set up as a means of bringing together, you know, movers and shakers in both sides of the Atlantic.
Well, that's their spin. It was set up to make sure the Europeans did what they were told by the Americans.
Well, exactly. But the point is that these elite groups will always find ways to meet. And if Bilderberg at one stage, as you know, Tony, didn't claim it didn't even exist. And of course, eventually it was proved that it did exist. And of course, Tony actually bought their domain name. So they had, and of course, then of course he was getting, if you'd like to say that when the guy from Malawi phoned you up to try and get an invite.
That was amusing. I was sitting having a cup of coffee in Gloucester Docks, and I got a phone call from the Prime Minister's office of Malawi because he wanted to join the Bilderbergs. And I had to tell him, well, first of all, you're talking to a journalist, nothing to do with the Bilderbergs. I am a critic of them. And by the way, you're not in NATO. It's the NATO countries that are part of Bilderberg. So, you know, I think it was, you know, just another developing country thinking, quite rightly thinking, we've been completely shut out of the whole process of running the world.
Well, that's right. I mean, we can see this now. This struggle over a multipolar world is right in front of everybody's eyes. You know, it's the biggest crisis since World War II. The way in which the West has run things for, you know, since World War II is up for grabs. And it's, you know, you can be absolutely certain that there are going to be big changes now, but whether they're going to be all good is another matter altogether.
Well, that's from the big stuff right down to the small stuff. And sound engineer Dave Bazanko pointed out to me that there's a wonderful new development in South Mead, which is new pavements and stuff and some new flower beds. Hanging over the top of them are these kind of happy city flags, telling everyone how happy they are and how happy they should be, which I find a little bit sinister. Something called Happy City, which is based here in Bristol, I think they've changed their name now to, can't remember the name of it, but the Centre for Thriving Places, that's right. In the most depressed, poverty-stricken parts of Bristol, what we're getting is nice flags telling us how happy we are. And I'm not sure this is a very good way to spend public money. But anyway, one of the reasons I'm talking about this now is because we did a dialect programme about 2017 with a guy called Sam Downey, who's a freelance journalist in Bristol here, who had done a critique of this Happy City group and saying, look, well, actually what they're doing is they're just funneling public money into trying to make people think they're fine, basically gaslighting people. You're fine, shut up, you know, that sort of thing. So anyway, let's have a listen now to this banned programme. I got hauled in front of the Mayor Marvin Rees's chum, Pat Hart, who was the managing editor of Bristol Community FM, for putting this out. And actually, it was, I think, nothing wrong with it at all. It's a fascinating insight by Sam Downey into some of these kind of psychological tactics which are used by organisations to try and tell people they're happy, even when they're being smashed and driven into the worst poverty that they've ever known.
One of the things which I've found out, Tony, is Common Purpose is now infiltrating the NHS, and they're using the NHS to bring it down. And this is kind of, it's one of the ways. So Bristol Health Partners have made it now public knowledge that they're working with Common Purpose, running these leadership training sessions with different organisers.
So this conference was the annual conference, and held at Bristol recently, a few weeks ago.
Yes.
One of the things from the programme that I found quite shocking was, and it's all about leadership, supposedly, is it was teaching participants at the conference to lead beyond their authority.
Yes.
So that means to say, effectively, to try to make decisions that you're not actually allowed to make.
Yeah.
So, in other words, to sort of strong arm and cajole your superiors into doing things that you want.
Yeah, exactly. And also that same expression, when I've looked into it, and the Common Purpose means of it, means that leading beyond their authority. So, if you look at authority as law, so what is beyond the law? Which that means breaking the law.
Yes, it could be civil or criminal offences being committed. Exactly. Also interesting that somebody from Common Purpose or the Common Purpose conference, somebody from Happy Cities pops up as one of the main speakers.
Yeah. This person is called David Ralph. And
okay, so who's he?
He's a director at Happy City. He's also the director of Bristol Health Partners as well.
Crikey. And what's his background?
His background is from the army, from Wiltshire.
Right. So does he have any health experience? He worked in the health service?
No, I've met him, and he's told me he has some experience in management, and that's it. So he's not health or medically trained at all. He also recently did some training at an event at Bristol City Council on the subject of welfare. And he did a whole session about ESA and PIP. Of course, so he's not actually versed in those things and doesn't know anything about benefits or benefit cuts.
So that's Sam Downey speaking on our dialect show that we used to do back in 2017, a midweek programme on Bristol Community FM, really describing these kind of training courses around local government run by this organisation called Common Purpose. Andrew, have you ever come across them?
No, I haven't. I mean, obviously, I'm a newly elected councillor, just been councillor for a year. When I was first elected, we do have an induction programme, a training programme. Most of it's in-house, and I have to say it was a pretty good programme, actually. I believe it's one credits from the local government authority association, but no, I haven't come across these.
Well,
people.
They're a sort of club, really, and the idea is that people just network amongst themselves, and it's interesting. I think fascinating for me to see that there is this theme running through so much nowadays. The mayor Marvin Rees has been through it too. The Yale World Fellows, you know, so people are told at a young age, we think you're leadership material. In a way, tapped up, you know, so you get a little tap on the shoulder. We think you're going to be great leadership material. And they're sent on this kind of fast-track course, a bit like the Rhodes Scholars in Oxford, Martin.
Yeah, well, this has been going on for a long time. You know, people like Bill Clinton are noticed at a very early stage and they say, right, we're going to give you help and support in your political career. And, of course, if you're ambitious, you often will take it. And of course, there's going to be questions about, you know, who's really pulling the strings in all this stuff, for sure.
One of the reasons we're looking at all this is because of, we are looking at it, but it'd be nice to think that the wider media would do so. Very little of that is happening. And one of the subjects I'll try and bring up as much as I can here, really, on this show, is what's happening to Julian Assange in Belmarsh Prison, which I think, the National Union of Journalists have been doing some sterling work in drawing attention to that. But, of course, he still languishes there. Andrew, it looks like any time now there'll be a decision made about whether to send Assange to the United States or not.
Yes, I'm not in favour of doing that. I don't think he'd get a fair trial over there. I think he's already been tried and sentenced to prison in the USA, so it's a foregone conclusion. It's a very difficult case, but I just don't think it's acceptable to extradite someone to a country that, you know, is not going to give him a fair trial.
Isn't it funny, about 8 years ago I seem to remember him saying, actually, when they're having a go at me about Sweden, what they really want to do is extradite me to the United States. And of course, he was completely right. Martin.
Yes, I mean, I think it's interesting to see, if you look at the mainstream political spectrum, I'm afraid it's only the usual suspects from the Labour campaign group who have come out saying that he should be released.
Yeah. There have been some reasonable voices in the press, but largely the press has been silent, hasn't it? Did you know, by the way, he got married in jail?
I didn't know that. I'm obviously aware of the appalling years he spent in the embassy of Ecuador. And just
and actually, Julian has not committed a crime. Well, he's
going to be extradited to stand trial under the US Espionage Act, which was brought in 1917 by the Congress in order to suppress anti-war sentiment in the run-up to US entry into World War One, and it was very controversial. Eugene Debs, who was the leader of the Socialist Party, was sentenced to years in prison, and Bill Hayden, who was the leader of the Industrial Workers of the World, fled to the Soviet Union to escape being arrested in the US, and then died in the Soviet Union. He's actually buried in the Kremlin wall as a hero of the Soviet Union. He died of natural causes. But but in the 1960s, they passed through the Congress that the US Espionage Act has extraterritorial jurisdiction.
This
anybody
so
in
shocking,
the world can be charged with espionage against the United States,
so
according to the United
States.
It's the
US trying to sort of extend its legal jurisdiction to the whole of the world. Anyway, there's a very good little piece put out by, I think it's, can't remember now, but... One of these alternative media groups, anyway, by Julian's wife and the mum of his kids, Stella Morris. Double Down News, it's called. That's right. Which she entitles, and this is a little clip from it now, "The CIA Plot to Kill My Husband, Julian Assange."
This is the most serious attack on press freedom there has ever been. The United States government is saying that any person, anywhere, is bound by the U.S. Espionage Act. This is a completely absurd and dangerous proposition. Julian is not a U.S. citizen. He's an Australian citizen who is working as a journalist in the United Kingdom. He owes no allegiance to the U.S. government. He received information from a source, Chelsea Manning, and he published it. That's all he did. And now the United States is threatening Julian with a life sentence, 175 years. It advances the absurd notion that a country can limit press freedom beyond its borders, that it can crack down on foreign journalists abroad. Imagine if Turkey now uses the same logic that the US has used to say that a British journalist in France should be extradited to Turkey because that journalist exposed some state-sponsored crime of Turkey's, or Saudi Arabia or China. Every journalist should be alarmed about this, because if they can do it to someone as high-profile as Julian, then everyone else can suffer the same fate. The fact that people have such a poor understanding about this case is down to the media. It is the media's responsibility to properly report this case, and it has not been properly reported. And that's why the public is so ignorant about it.
My favorite allegation is that I'm a cat torturer. No, seriously, AFP, Agence France-Presse, put that everywhere, even into New York Times. I don't really know where to start for people who aren't familiar with this kind of disgusting machine that the media is.
Now, why has the media reported so poorly about this case? Part of the reason is because Julian is a media critic. He's not just a publisher, but he has been very critical of the way that the media has reported, for example, WikiLeaks publications. WikiLeaks also poses a challenge to the legacy media, because the WikiLeaks model is what Julian calls scientific journalism, to publish original source documents alongside the analysis in order to allow the reader to draw their own conclusions, to access the same information that the journalist did in order to assess the material themselves. And that's why WikiLeaks is such an important resource for academics and historians, not just journalists. Because Julian's case is a political case, it's entirely up to the political circumstances what is possible and what is not possible. I ask each of you to help me fight for Julian. Go to don'textraditeassange.com. There's a tab that says Take Action. Take all the actions where it says Take Action. Write to your MP. Come to the protests. There may be a way that you are specially placed to help me free Julian. Please contact me directly. Every person can contribute to help fight for his freedom, help bring him home, help reunite Julian with our young children. It is incredibly important that stories that don't get enough airtime in the mainstream media are able to be covered elsewhere. I encourage each person that can afford it to support independent journalists, independent media like Double Down News. So if you can, please support Double Down News on Patreon.
Yes, Double Down News. She reminded me at the end there. So it's not the sort of message there is not just about Julian Assange, Andrew. It's about the mass media really not doing its job.
Yes, absolutely. I think Julian Assange has clearly suffered enough. And as I said before, he's not going to get a fair trial in the USA. They've already basically tried him and chucked him in prison in his absence. So, you know, I don't think it's acceptable for him to be sent to the USA. That's not something I would support, not at all.
In The Guardian, Peter Oborne has a piece out today on this. In the course of the next few days, he says, Priti Patel will make the most important ruling on free speech made by any Home Secretary in recent memory. She must resolve whether to comply with the US request to extradite Julian Assange on espionage charges. The consequences for Assange will be profound. Once in the US, he'll almost certainly be sent to a maximum security prison for the rest of his life. He will die in jail.
Well, yes, and I think the other thing about this, of course, is that why has the British legal system been shown to be so pathetic? I mean, Keir Starmer used to be Director of Public Prosecutions. I'm not a lawyer, but I can't see that there's any basis in English common law for this trial to be proceeding at all.
Actually, Starmer was involved in
he's not committed any crime in this country. And you can't be extradited. In fact, the extradition law that we have says you can't be extradited for political reasons. It's specific. Mm. But it's all been basically the trial has been a travesty. And the judges have actually been I can't remember Barrett's one of the judges is actually married to an MOD stalwart.
So let's just take a look at Priti Patel, who's going to make this decision in the next few days, for a minute, because she was International Development Secretary, wasn't she? Back in, I think it was 2015. I'm not sure absolutely of my dates, but she was on holiday in Israel. Only she wasn't on holiday in Israel.
That's right, she had to resign, didn't she?
What was she doing in Israel? Having 13 or so meetings with Israeli officials. So this is the woman, and you know, we all know how powerful the Israel lobby is in the United States with groups like AIPAC, etc. So there seems to be an Israeli state connection here, potentially. And it would be horrific if that's the sort of pressure that's been put on her, the lobbying pressure, because she certainly does seem to be the sort of Home Secretary that will bow to pressure from lobbyists rather than do the right thing. I mean, that's her track record, really.
Well, she probably believes that he should be extradited and sent to prison. That's the reality of it. And, of course, she's very pro-Israel. She's saying now that anybody who campaigns for a boycott or disinvestment of Israel is anti-Semitic. And you may see that the government has stopped all cooperation with the National Union of Students because they invited the rapper Loki to one of their conferences, who's a prominent critic of the Israeli government. Something like the Assange case is a very crucial thing, because when the history books come to be written and they say, well, when did we lose a democracy? And it may be, that may be what will happen. It'll be things like that, because people walk by on the other side of the road. It's like the famous poem by Pastor Niemöller, you know, they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist, so I said nothing. Then they came for the socialists, and I wasn't a socialist, so I said nothing, and so on. And when they came for me, there was nobody left to speak.
An excellent article by Peter Obon, really terrific. He's a lovely writer. US stated that Assange actively encouraged Manning to provide the information. How disgraceful. No wonder Kenneth Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, has warned that it is dangerous to suggest that these actions are somehow criminal, rather than steps routinely taken by journalists who communicate with sources to receive information about public importance. You know, so he's just doing his job. That's what journalists do. They encourage people to talk to them. You know, that's basically what we're here for, folks. Despite all this, Peter says, there's no reason to suppose that Patel will come to Assange's rescue, that there may yet be further legal ways to fight extradition. Even if Patel wasn't already on the way to winning the all corners record as the most repressive Home Secretary in modern history, the Johnson government, already in Joe Biden's bad books, has no incentive to further alienate the US president. And of course, part of that is this police crime courts and evidence bill, which is making protest almost illegal. I mean, many forms of protest, like noisy protests, you've got to have a timed protest, only happened it's between X and Y times, and not to mention the criminalizing of gypsies and travelers. So he goes on to say, and if and when Assange is put on a plane to the US, investigative journalism will suffer a permanent and deadening blow. And the message will be sent to war criminals, not just in the US, but in every country around the globe, that they can commit their crimes with impunity. So that's Peter Obon. And pretty shocking stuff, I think, that is about that decision, which is going to be made over the next few days. But final item before the break is on the another journalistic item, and that came up at it wasn't Prime Minister's questions, it was Foreign Office questions on Monday with the Foreign Office Minister Vicky Ford, and Zahra Sultana brought up the death of the Palestinian American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh last week, shot in the head by an Israeli sniper.
Thank you, Speaker. As if the ongoing dispossession and discrimination faced by the Palestinian people wasn't enough cruelty, Israel continuously targets Palestinian journalists. It is not only the murder by Israeli snipers of Shireen Abu Akleh, who for decades bravely reported the crimes inflicted on her people. Since 2000, Israel has killed an estimated 51 Palestinian journalists, and an independent UN commission of inquiry found out that during the 2018 March of Return, Israeli snipers intentionally shot Palestinian journalists who were clearly marked as such, killing Yasser Mutaja and Ahmed Abu Hussein. So what will it take for the government to stop equivocating over these horrific crimes, to hold Israel to account for its routine violations of international humanitarian law, and for the seventh time, will the minister summon the Israeli ambassador?
Minister. Mr. Speaker, we stand by journalists all across the world, and it is a tragedy that so many journalists have been killed in recent years, and in particular in this year. That is why we continue to raise issues of media freedom on the global stage. Back in February in Estonia, we announced support for the Secretariat for the Media Freedom Coalition, the Media Freedom Coalition, which we founded, now has 52 members, and we will absolutely stand for media freedom and for journalists all across the world.
Well, that's... Foreign Office Minister Vicky Ford completely failing to answer the question whatsoever, didn't even mention Palestine or anything to do with Israel or the name of the murdered journalist. What do you make of this whole situation? I realise it's not on your...
As a
Bristol City Councillor. Yeah. But it, of course, it is an enormous issue for many people in the city who've got allegiances one way or the other. And I think everyone is pretty concerned about what's going on in the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a tragedy, isn't it? It's been going on for so many years. And, you know, the people do have a way forward, you know, a Palestinian state and a two-state solution that does seem to be a viable solution. But we seem to be as far away from it as ever. And, you know, this recent killing was absolutely shocking. And what was even more shocking, I don't know if you saw the scenes at the funeral, with the coffin being jostled around and the mourners being jostled around. It's absolutely appalling.
This is by the Israeli police.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's just no way to behave. And
well, we also had, didn't we, over Easter, we had Israeli riot police going into the mosque. I mean, can you imagine... Here in Bristol, Avon and Somerset Constabulary charging into the cathedral in the middle of a service. You know, there's something funny going on over there. Martin, anyway. Well, even Martin in a second. But after, I was quite surprised to see Conservative MP Crispin Blunt weighing in on this one too.
Crispin Blunt.
Speaker, I draw the attention of the House to my declaration in the Register as a founder director of the International Centre of Justice for Palestinians. In respect of this, since then, I have avoided engagement on Palestinian issues in this House. But this opposition urgent question... In respect of the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, almost certainly by targeted shot coming from the forces who are in illegal occupation of Palestinian territory, allow me to ask, how long must we wait for the United Kingdom to actually do anything to enforce accountability for the State of Israel on its gross and worsening breach of 55 years of the Fourth Geneva Convention, noting the shaming contrast well, our own brave and principled policy towards Ukraine.
Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My honourable friend is right to be concerned. The UK government is very concerned about this very fragile security situation in Jerusalem. We continue to call on all parties to de-escalate tensions. The British ambassador to Israel and the British Consul General in Jerusalem have been engaging with Israeli and Palestinian leaderships to support them in restoring calm. We've made it clear that there's a need to protect holy sites. This sort of horrific violence against civilians is truly contemptible, and we absolutely call on all sides to de-escalate the situation and come to the dialogue tables and work towards peace.
Martin?
Well, it's good to hear Crispin Blunt, is it? I mean, he's rather on the wet wing of the Tory party, isn't he? He's not really very...
He wasn't being wet there, was he?
No, he wasn't. He was being quite straightforward. Well, it is extraordinary, but you see, Priti Patel is talking about making anybody who calls for a boycott of Israel, that to be a criminal offence.
Hang on, I call for a boycott of Israel. Is it a criminal offence?
Well, in the US, there's various states have passed laws.
We had this in the 1980s, and it did a hell of a lot of good in South Africa.
Well, exactly. This is the point: is that the Palestinian leadership are calling exactly for that. You know, that if you cut off aid and trade, you certainly don't supply them with weaponry. Israel is a very flawed democracy because actually the majority of the local people don't vote in it. And, you know, the only way to put pressure on democracies is to make it their pocketbook. I mean, the Israeli state essentially survives on subventions from the US government. to the tune of thousands of dollars per person per year. I guess
that's the one thing that might make these stand up if you take
the money off them, they might suddenly realise that in actual fact, they've got a demographic problem. People don't want to go there. And if you got rid of their middle class lifestyle, which is paid for by the US taxpayer, then maybe they wouldn't go there. And of course, it's a very strong contrast to all of the, what's happened over the Ukraine, where immediately everybody jumps on the bandwagon. We've got to have sanctions. Whether they work or not is another matter. We're probably going to discuss that.
Yes, we will. In the second Michael part. Hudson's got a few things to say about that. Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, you know, people in the world can see the hypocrisy. If you look at the way the world has voted around the Ukraine stuff, is that, you know, when you've got an axe to grind and everybody's got to jump and join your posse, but when all these other things have been going on for years, not only do you not intervene, you actually support, in many ways, militarily support people doing things like this.
I mean, when
the weaponry is paid for by US taxpayers.
When people talk about Israeli apartheid, do you think that's fair, comparing it to what happened in South Africa, the racism there?
Well, clearly the situation in Israel and Palestine is unacceptable. And, they have built a wall. So, you know, that's a symbol of apartheid, isn't it? You know, build a wall to keep people out. And, it's just... We just seem as far away from a solution as ever, and it's so depressing. And, you know, there is a good solution. And you know, as Martin said, unfortunately, America keeps sending money to Israel, and they're not going to change their ways. So it's down to America, really, isn't it, you know, to ensure there's change. But I can't see that happening anytime soon.
Well, maybe the British could be bargaining with the Americans and saying, look, you're only going to get Assange back if you stop giving money to Israel. That's actually how these diplomatic things work, isn't it? We've got, for example, we've got that, Anne Sekulis, who is wanted in the UK for driving into and killing a guy, and then she fled back to the United States. So these are the sorts of deals which diplomats should be doing, but of course they very rarely do anyway. End of part one now. We'll be back in part two in a minute. Thanks ever so much to Andrew Varney, who's the Lib Dem councillor for Brislington West. Fascinating to hear your take on all these subjects, particularly on the what's happening with the mayor. And we'll be back after the break.
Thank you.
Well, I'm on my way to heaven. We shall not be moved. On our way to heaven, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the water's side, we shall not be. We
sail. Real live one. Yeah. Yeah, it's a real live person for sale. I have my values anyway. Clothing, no extra charge, of course. Buy me now, go on. Buy me now. Save yourself. Get a gnome for your home. Or an angel in a taxi cab. Or a corpse in a London bus. Or a fairy in your dairy milking Betty Cat. All you gotta do is buy me and I'm yours. All yours. No extra charge. And my hair is real, I tell you. It's real. I beat as I sleep, as I dream. You could have me today. No deposit. And I'm interest-free too. Interest free. Isn't that enough? Take me and I will love you. Love you. Love you. Love you. And then eat you. Eat you. Thank 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 you. Swallow your whole. Master! Your word is law. Wipe your feet on my mouth and I'll wait at your door. Am I really wanted? Am I wanted? Is my head to be rented till demented? Look. I'm no brothel full of philosophic muscle. I'm no menstruating minstrel in a bedroom with no headroom. I'm no rotten, ill-gotten corpse of cold glutton to be bought cheap, so pass it, purchasers!
Hey, man, what's happening?
So that's The Fall from 1988. Before that, David Allen from 1981. The Fall's The Curious Orange Overture. Orange Overture. I suppose I should say it like that. You can't say orange, can you? And David Allen's Poet for Sale from 1981. Before that, We Shall Not Be Moved by The Seekers from 1965. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Now, we've already had a bit of a clip, Martin, linking it with the Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, and the World Economic Forum, and the various mayors around the world, of this signing of this treaty by the World Health Organization. Now, why is it that mayors are getting together to encourage the rule? Well, it's not the rule. This is a treaty which is, there's a petition, there are various petitions around, but obviously the most important one is the parliamentary petition to sign on this World Health Organization treaty, that people are rather concerned that if governments around the world sign up to this World Health Organization treaty, they're basically ceding power to the WHO.
Well, I think the World Health Organization is a deeply flawed institution.
Is it more or less flawed than the Department for Health?
Well, they're different. You know, the Department for Health is a British institution. The World Health Organization aspires to be an international organization. I think there are worries about all of this stuff, but the fact is that the national interests are being asserted more strongly than ever. You know, you can see this over the war in the Ukraine. The idea that there's going to be one supranational government run by the Western oligarchs, not philanthropists, is basically finding the problem that the large parts of the world, they're not having any of it, and they're going to war to stop it.
Well, anyway, it'd be interesting to see if this does get past, the British Parliament, that they do sign up to this. But it does seem like a definite attempt at world government, aided and abetted by these various mayors around the world.
The InfoWars line on this is that the US government, which should be sovereign, is being undermined by international organisations.
Let us not make out that the InfoWars is the only critique of it. It's been critiqued all over the world right now, this World Health Organization, by all sorts of different NGOs, individuals, journalists. So, you know, everyone is concerned about the mismanagement of the COVID pandemic, particularly the stopping of basic cures and treatments for it. And now they're saying, oh, well, this went so well, let's make it formal and put them in charge. Well, of course, this is absurd, ridiculous, dangerous, extremely dangerous. Anyway, talking about health, it's a kind of a tangent, but it's not in a way, is about cancer, because we never hear the World Health Organization talking about ionizing radiation causing cancer. And yet Dr. Chris Busby, we had the report that went out with last week's show and was linked to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Chris is basically exiled from Britain. He's a scientist who's done lots of studies, very, very important, I think, anyway, on the effect of ionising radiation on cancer and other things. I mean, for example, explaining these leukemia clusters around nuclear power stations and other nuclear plants in the UK, which are supposed by the industry and by government to be just pure coincidence. Chris has absolutely categorically proved they are not coincidence, that actually nuclear power is far more dangerous than we realise. And he also makes the point that the atmospheric tests done of nuclear weapons in the 1950s may well have had a massive effect on increasing cancers around the world. So anyway, I thought we'd start part two this week by having a good old listen to Chris. And here is his own summary of his own report, which is just out, and it's just peer-reviewed. And it's, a paper entitled Ionising Radiation and Cancer, The Failure of the Risk Model.
Right from the very beginning, radiation was measured in a way that was quite reasonable if you're measuring radiation in the environment, but not reasonable if you're measuring radiation in a human being. The idea that was put forward round about the time of the Manhattan Project, when they really started to look at the health effects of internal radiation, that's like plutonium that you swallow or inhale, you know, strontium-90 that you swallow or inhale or eat through the milk, where it gets into the milk and so on. that sort of radiation is not the same as the radiation that you get externally from gamma rays and X-rays, because gamma rays and X-rays can be averaged over the whole body. It's like a form of light that goes through you, and the absorption of that dangerous light in the form of ionization is more or less uniform across the whole of your body. And so the method of saying that you can develop this idea for measuring radiation in what's called absorbed dose, and that's how it's done. That's how it's done now. They say your dose is 2 millisieverts, or your dose is 100 millisieverts, or after Chernobyl, nobody got more than 5 millisieverts who lived in Belarus, this sort of thing. So it's always about dose. And dose, from the very beginning, was defined in terms of energy per unit mass. So in other words, you can take the mass of your body, and you can take the energy from the gamma ray and the amount of energy that's absorbed, and you can divide one by the other, and you get dose. And this is a very simple measure, joules per kilogram. And so that's the first thing that was done right from the beginning, 1952. So they argued that dose was a measure of radiation effect, and that internal radiation could be measured in the same way. And this was the problem, because internal radiation cannot be measured in the same way, because certain types of internal isotopes, internal radioactive chemicals like strontium-90 and uranium-238, all the uraniums, is that they have a very strong chemical affinity for DNA. And by about 1970, it had become, as a result of a lot of studies of radiation, it became clear that DNA was the target for radiation effects which led to cancer. What radiation did was it caused a mutation in the DNA, and that mutation then continued to get copied to the daughter cells, and copied and copied and copied, until there were so many cells that had the right amount of DNA damage for those cells to go and start to replicate and become cancers. But nothing was done about this. Nobody said, well, obviously internal radiation from strontium-90 is much more dangerous than external radiation at the same dose. And as a result of this, this model became the model that still exists today. And so when they wanted to know the health effects of radiation, they went back and looked at the people who were living in Hiroshima at the time of the Hiroshima bomb. And they started a study in 1952, about 7 years after the bomb exploded. And they started to say, well, you know, the dose of people who were standing closer to the bomb was higher than the dose of people who were standing like 1 kilometer away. And that was lower than the dose of people standing 3 kilometers away. And on the basis of that, they drew a straight line through the cancer yield in this in the people who they had in this lifespan study, which was funded by the Americans. And so on the basis of that, they say we know how many cancers are caused by a certain dose, and that's called the risk model. But that risk model is no good for internal radiation, because the dose from internal radiation from substances which are bound to the DNA through chemical affinity is absolutely enormous, quite clearly so, because the DNA is like the target for the radiation effect, and here you are, you swallow something, and it goes into your bloodstream, it ends up in the DNA on your cells, and then it goes bang, so it blows a hole through the DNA, and then and that introduces a mutation, and you go on and get cancer. So this was the essential problem, and this is the essential argument that I laid out in the paper that I just wrote. And the other thing, that, of course, that was an earlier paper that I published last year about the Hiroshima study, was to point out that actually it's possible to show quite clearly that most of the cancers that came along after Hiroshima were nothing to do with the external dose. They were to do with the fact that the rain fell after Hiroshima, the black rain, and people got contaminated by the black rain, and it brought down all these particles of uranium, which were particles from the original bomb, and this stuff got into people, and then that was what caused the cancer in the low and medium dose groups. And in fact, the Japanese government was taken to court about a year ago, and they lost the case on this issue. So the Japanese government, and they won't appeal the case, the Japanese government have implicitly agreed that the current risk model is wrong. So the rest of the paper was about the ways in which dishonest scientists and dishonest epidemiologists who've been employed by the nuclear military complex and through universities, groups and so forth, have consistently written dishonest scientific and epidemiological reports, which try to argue that these effects, the dose effects, are very good. They're very well studied, and everybody knows everything to do with radiation now. And the people who think that it's dangerous to live near a nuclear power station are just emotional, and they don't understand science, and all the usual stuff that the anti-nuclear groups get when they stand up and they say, "Hey, look, we don't want to look at we don't want to live near a nuclear site because we're all dying." And they say, "Oh, ha ha, you're not scientists. You don't really understand the science. You don't understand mathematics," and so on. But actually, those people are wrong. They're dishonest scientists. They should all go to jail, in my opinion. But that's what this paper says. What it says is that this risk model is wrong. Now, the consequence of that, the main consequence of that, is that if the risk model is wrong for internal radiation, we have to go back and look to see what's happening to people who've been exposed to internal radiation. Well, of course, people who live downwind of Hinkley Point are exposed to internal radiation because it comes out of the chimneys, the stacks, and it blows across into Burnham-on-Sea North, where we find all these cancer effects, and the same at Trasvenneth in Wales, and the same in Bradwell, and probably the same everywhere, though, you know, time limits the amount of these studies you can do. But the main injection of these radionuclides into the planetary, into the biosphere, was between 1959 and 63, when they were doing all these atmospheric tests in the Pacific and in Russia and in the Nevada test site and New Mexico, Alamogordo. And this produced large quantities of all sorts of completely novel radionuclides, things that had never really existed on Earth before, including concentrated forms of radionuclides like the uranium series, which, although they existed before, were tied up safely in the ground. But then they were, in order to make the bombs, they had to dig them out and refine them and make them pure, then throw them up into the atmosphere and blow them up. So all the stuff then rained down all over the place, got into the food supply, people inhaled it, people ate it, so on, between 1959 and 63. And if we look at the true effects of this and calculate it on a global scale, we can relate these exposures quite easily to the cancer epidemic, which began in about 1979, 1980 in Wales, and about 85, 86 in England, because it starts earlier if you get a bigger contamination. And Wales was much more contaminated because of rainfall. And when we do that, we find the approximate error in the risk model is about 300 to 500 times. And so this cancer epidemic that began in 1980, the one that we see now we see one in two people are going to acquire cancer in their lifetime. In the 50s, it was one in nine people. And in the 90s, it was about one in five people. Then it was one in three. Now it's going to be one in two. And nobody says, where does this come from? Because these are age-related increases. So you know, they're age specific rates. They're not because it's an older population. They are real. And when you multiply this out over the population of the world, this 30%, 40% increase from the strontium-90 and the uranium and the plutonium and all the rest of that stuff, you get 300 million extra cancers that are absolutely laid at the door of the nuclear military complex and their nuclear testing and their dishonest cover-up of the way in which these things work. They know all this. They absolutely know all this. My friend Bill Pritchard was at the Sizewell inquiry, and he went to the pub with some of these people, and they said, we're told not to talk about internal radiation.
So there you go, from the horse's mouth. That is interesting, isn't it, to hear him right at the very end there with this kind of cutting comment right at the very end, saying, well, actually, the nuclear industry know about this, and we've heard it from their own mouths.
Well, yes. And of course, the military wing of the nuclear industry have known all along that what they're doing is potentially going to destroy the whole of humanity. So, and the mentality is some people have to die on the way to this final Armageddon. Well, that's just too bad.
Well, the main things to digest from what Chris is saying there, if he's correct, which I've got no reason to believe he's not, he's certainly one of the most trustworthy, knowledgeable, and courageous scientists I've ever come across, is, and also, of course, is a peer-reviewed paper, as linked on last week's show. It's fully referenced, is 400 times. So that's what he's basically saying, is the current radiation risk model that they use in all their planning applications, etc., their way they convince, for example, in contracts of people that work there, is 400 times wrong, basically. It's the danger to any individual from any proximity to the nuclear power station and from breathing air around it, etc., he's saying is 400 times more than they're admitting to.
Well, call me unshocked. I mean, it's great that somebody has done the necessary research to prove it, but it's always been pretty obvious that it's very, very dangerous stuff. And we'd probably be better off without it.
We're being bamboozled, we're being gaslighted, etc. And what about these estimated 300 million cancer deaths that haven't really been acknowledged as being due to radiation?
Well, I think that is very, you know, if you can make that stand up, that's devastating, isn't it? What we're talking about is that once you have exploded these bombs, which is basically where most of this has come from, then, you know, future generations are going to be affected going forward for, you know, for any foreseeable future. And you know, the danger of us blowing ourselves up in nuclear war is by far the most dangerous thing we face. And I'm not you know, and climate change will happen possibly if we haven't blown ourselves up, but the priority has got to be the other way around. In the 80s we were much more aware of the danger of nuclear war. But of course, another generation of young people has come up who sees the danger in terms of climate change.
Do you think that the boss of the World Health Organization, the former politician Tedros Ghebreyesus, I think I never quite know how to pronounce his name, Bejesus or something, isn't it? Ghebreyesus or something, is aware of any of this that he's talking about, even though there's this massive potential health risk to the entire world's population?
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about what he knows. I mean, he's
not, you know, saying anything about it, Martin.
Well, no, okay, but I mean, he's, you know, don't forget that lots of governments around the world, including the British government, have got a nuclear deterrent, as they like to call it, and so there's a lot of vested interests who really don't want this stuff out. And since the WHO, in theory, is a governmental organisation, governments are the ones with nuclear weapons. They're not the ones that are going to, you know, they're not going to campaign to have it all exposed, are they?
No, and I think another thing which was pointed out by one of the Stop Hinkley people a couple of months ago here on this show was that the civil nuclear industry is not only very important for producing plutonium to make bombs with, it's also a kind of stable where people who go on to do nuclear weapons can learn the trade.
Yeah, well, I think that once you've decided to have nuclear weapons, that's a political decision. It's governments that decide they want nuclear weapons, and they then invest in those nuclear weapons. But then you've got all this waste, and you don't know what to do with it. And that's why nuclear power was generated as a means. You know, we got to get something back from all the money we've wasted on developing these weapons. And I don't. Absent nuclear weapons, and nuclear power would be totally unviable. You know, you wouldn't build a nuclear power station from scratch unless you had loads of fissionable material hanging around and scientists trained to use it. You'd do something much more simple. I mean, at the end of the day, a nuclear power station is just a very fancy way of boiling a kettle. And so there's nothing, you know, it's, and of course it's not really viable, as I've stressed week after week on this show. But of course, once you've got a nuclear industry, it doesn't make sense to just close it down overnight because the waste isn't going to go
this
away.
What the Germans are trying to do.
Well, that's right. Well, because that's making your politics based on emotion. rather than reason. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't, it's perfectly legitimate to get rid of, you know, to decide we don't want the nuclear industry, but you can't just do it in one go. And attempting to do it in one go, will, you basically lose a load of money if you do that. And that means you've got less money to do other things with. You can run it down. It's what it's in the economics textbook. You, as long as you're covering your variable costs, you're just going to write off the fixed costs of developing the stations. And, of course, you don't want to generate any more waste. There's already far too much of it, and it's going to be a burden on future generations for God knows how long.
Okay, so the whole idea of World Health Organization taking over our policy about what happens with our health is such a shocking, concerning idea. I thought we'd also revisit some, I mean, this is actually a much more recent interview to do with the pandemic, where a BBC radio presenter discusses the side effects that she's experiencing or experienced after receiving the COVID jab.
I sometimes scream at Jeremy Vine on his BBC show when I'm driving, the radio show, not the TV one, because he's just so pro-vax. And I've certainly heard presenters shutting up people that are on the show when they're just giving another side, our side, basically. My local paper did a story. I used to write a business column for them, so the Whitstable Times. They wrote a story from my tweets. And the young journalist, that was last May 21, the young journalist said, keep us informed, and they've never written anything else. So I think there's been, you know, I think that these the media have been told to be quiet. I think it must be that. They don't want to hear another side. People are dropping like flies. I've got groups of people. I get messages most days, DMs, and all of our symptoms are so similar. It's like a nerve damage, you know, as you know, we've got people bedridden 5-6 months. As you know, Alex Mitchell, who you're interviewing later with Dan Wootton, he's had his leg amputated. It's an endless list. And even in my everyday life, if I'm having my nails done or something, the young girl there had Pfizer and she hasn't had her period since last summer. She gets migraines, which she never had, and she's ill. I've seen her just go downhill from these two Pfizers, and I'm frustrated.
So that's a programme which was not only approved by the World Health Organization, but very much pushed by the World Health Organization. You're hearing that was Jules Serkin, the BBC radio presenter, ex-journalist on the Whitstable Times, she said there. Jules Serkin is J-U-L-E-S-S-E-R-K-I-N, Jules Serkin, discussing the side effects of these vaccines. Martin, you know, this is a scandal in a way that's been kind of sidelined by the wall-to-wall coverage of Ukraine.
Well, I mean, obviously, we've been discussing this issue of mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and the Western pharmaceutical companies. They are bad actors. But, of course, there are vaccines out there which are not based on mRNA technology, and they've been used, for example, Sputnik has been used all over the world. It's not based on mRNA technology. The Chinese Sinopharm vaccine isn't based on our mRNA technology. So, yes, if it turns out that these are very dangerous technologies, then it will be the West that has done it.
Drop the if. Can we just drop the if for a moment? Because I don't think there's any doubt in my mind whatsoever about these things being incredibly dangerous for younger people, particularly who are not vulnerable from COVID. Anyway, so another piece of news on a similar line this week, and I've got no audio clip for you because the guy reads it all out in Russian. He's someone from the Russian military. Pfizer and Moderna involved in US military biological activities in Ukraine, says the Russian Defense Ministry. This was released on the 11th of May. Major pharmaceutical companies, including coronavirus vaccine makers Pfizer and Moderna, have been involved in the US military biological activities in Ukraine. This was stated by the head of the Russian Armed Forces, Radiation, Chemical and Biological Protection Troops, Igor Kirillov, during a briefing in Moscow last week. While socially significant diseases such as HIV infection, polio, measles, hepatitis are a priority for the Ukrainian healthcare, US customers are interested in completely different ones: cholera, tularemia, whatever that is, plague, and hantaviruses, the Defence Ministry employee underlined. Kirillov specified that the facts of working with these pathogens, which might be potential components of biological weapons, have been confirmed by his forces who've been conducting surveillance of these biological warfare facilities in Ukraine after the invasion by Russia. That's me calling it an invasion, not him, of course. He'd probably get sacked for saying it was an invasion. He added that American experts are testing new drugs, avoiding international safety standards in Ukraine, using it as a kind of way of getting out from doing any kind of proper due diligence by doing it in Ukraine with no supervision and no regulations. Earlier, the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry called Russian statements on the creation of biological weapons in Ukraine disinformation and provocation. So this is, I think, a bit of an interesting revelation from the Russian Defence Ministry. We should be being told about this, but of course it's blocked. We're not allowed to hear anything about these revelations from Russia, that these activities have been going on, and not just a military programme from the Pentagon. This is Pfizer and Moderna too, actively pursuing biological activities in Ukraine, Martin.
Well, it looks as if Hunter Biden and was involved in all of this, and you know, the stuff on his laptop confirms it. And of course, this is really where I think this may be one of the reasons why the Russians have carried out their special military operation, as they call it, is because I think that the Russian and Chinese intelligence services are very well aware that COVID-19 was a biological warfare agent. I sent you something weeks ago from people doing studies in the US looking at documents showing that they actually had COVID-19 in these biological warfare labs in the Ukraine before it became a known pathogen. Now, that's very revealing if it can be stood up. And, of course, Dilyana Gatasheva looked into all of this in 2018. Incidentally, she has closed down her blog.
Oh, yes, she's put it up for sale, hasn't she?
Yeah, because I think she's been put under pressure of some kind.
Well, I imagine it's financial pressure. I think that's it is. She would love to continue her journalism, but, of course, you can't do it on thin air.
No, you can't. Now, I think a lot, you know, there was an awful lot of...
Isn't it armswatch.org, I think, is her site. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant person. Diliana, our heart goes out to you. I really hope that you manage to, you know, somebody manages to send you some donations or whatever so you can carry on doing that work, or that you manage to sell it, you know, because actually it was her that was one of the first people right at the beginning of this Ukraine business to put her finger on right on the money, Ukraine bioweapon labs.
That's right. Now, of course, what this means is that everything that's happened in the last 3 or 4 years is World War III. That's what it is. We're in it. And all the people that have died, the millions that have died from the virus and from the vaccines, are all war casualties. We're at war.
Yes, well, it seems to be sort of ramping up bit by bit, doesn't it? And I think when we're talking about the so-called vaccines, the jabs, I think is probably the best way to call them, these Pfizer and Moderna messing about in Ukraine jabs that were given to people that absolutely definitely don't need them, as we were hearing that horrific report from the... BBC journalist a minute ago. The whole point of all this, though, is that we've got we've had a tradition of basically allowing anybody that criticises the vaccine industry to be destroyed. And we're going to hear now a longer clip from the James Dellingpole's podcast. With a woman called Sally Beck, who's a freelance journalist, who goes into, I think she did a fascinating job, brilliant job here, and he did, into the whole story about Andrew Wakefield, because, of course, everyone has been programmed by the London media to believe that Andrew Wakefield, who's no longer a doctor, he was struck off, has been totally discredited. Of course, the opposite is the truth. He was right on the money, and he was destroyed by the, not by the medical profession as a whole, but by some of these General Medical Council and other official bodies, which apparently it seems have been completely taken over by the vaccine industry, in order to destroy him and destroy his career. But anyways, I thought the fascinating story about what actually happened with Andrew Wakefield and how he was criticising the vaccine industry, successfully managing to do it, and then destroyed.
So the story ended in 2010 when he was struck off by the GMC, accused of callous disregard were the exact words.
So where was he before? Just tell us.
He was at the Royal Free Hospital.
Right.
He was a paediatric gastroenterologist at the Royal Free Hospital. And the Royal Free, from about 1996 onwards, had parents contacting them. Andrew Wakefield had done a study into wild measles and how it could cause Crohn disease, because he's a gastroenterologist and that was his area of interest. But from 1996, the Royal Free began getting letters from parents. And it wasn't just one or two letters. They had over 1,000 parents contact them saying, my child was fine until they had their MMR vaccination. And now they have bowel disease. They can't go to the loo. They're very badly constipated. And they also have autism. Could you please investigate? So the parents, they had a 2-year waiting list at one point at the Royal Free. So the parents came to see Andrew Wakefield and his team, and they told their story, and they all had very similar stories. And as a clinician, it was the clinical indications were that these children needed a colonoscopy to see what was going on with their bowel. Why weren't they going to the loo? And did it have anything to do with their autism? And fast forward to the 1998 case study that was published in The Lancet. So 12 children from 11 families had biopsies at the Royal Free Hospital. And what they were looking for in these biopsies was the bowel disease. And also they were looking for the measles virus. And what they found in these children's guts was vaccine strain measles virus. And they also found that they had a sort of novel bowel disease. It wasn't quite Crohn's. It wasn't IBS. It wasn't anything they'd really seen before. Andrew Wakefield had done a lot of investigation into the safety studies of the MMR. Now, what you might not know, that two versions of that jab were withdrawn because they were causing encephalitis and inflammation of the brain, essentially, in children. So two versions were withdrawn, and it was the Urabi component, which was the mumps component of the vaccination that was causing those problems. So we, first of all, we had the measles jab in 68. Then they added measles and rubella, and that was about 10 years later. And then they added measles, mumps and rubella, and that we got that in 1988. But what's really interesting, James, is that the only one of those diseases that could cause actually serious damage to a child is the measles. And it was very rare that that happened. The year that they bought in the MMR, there were 35 deaths from measles that year. And the deaths from measles had dropped from about the back of the 1800s, from over 1,000 deaths a year, down to double figures. So they'd reduced by about 98%, and they'd been consistently that low for quite a long time. It wasn't particularly the single measles jab that made any difference. Doctors say what made the difference was better food, better housing, clean water, and better healthcare. And also our immune systems learned how to deal with measles. So it wasn't actually, if you were budgeting to spend your money, you'd have been better off spending your money not on the MMR, but on a road safety campaign. That would have saved more children's lives in a year. So you were, yes. And to put it in context, you get about 1,500 deaths a year from asthma. And so we were getting, no one worries about, you know, there's no outcry about asthma, is there? No one says, oh my God, asthma's so appalling. We must do something about asthma. We just accept that people die from asthma, and 1,500 deaths a year. And measles, we were getting 35, and that was a bad year. It had actually been 16 deaths the year before. Anyway, back to Andrew Wakefield and his team. They would have been negligent had they not investigated. But instead of, and what they did was they looked at the safety studies, and The safety studies for the single measles vaccine had been done at St George's in Tooting on what they described as idiots and imbeciles. One child had died in the study and they'd simply replaced that child. They'd been using Down syndrome children and children with low IQ. So they reviewed the safety studies. They thought these safety studies are, you know, not really worth the paper they're written on. They discussed it. They discussed, should we have a press conference to announce our findings? The Dean of the Royal Free agreed they should have this press conference, and they knew that a journalist would ask them, is the MMR causing autism? And the answer to that was, we don't know, but we would like the government to suspend the MMR and reintroduce the single vaccine so that we could do some more research into it.
Yeah.
All very sensible. The government presumably thought, what if the MMR isn't what we say it is? What's that going to cost us in compensation? You know, maybe there's, what if we have to pay 1,000 children £1 million in compensation? That's going to be huge. So let's not suspend the MMR. Let's increase confidence in the MMR vaccine and all this will go away. And it didn't go away, obviously. It bumbled on. And then a journalist called Brian Deer wrote a story for the Sunday Times, essentially accusing Andrew Wakefield of misleading the country over the MMR. And, you know, that's how it all began to unfold.
What do we know about Brian Deer? I mean, was he a regularly used writer or was he unusual?
He was a freelance. He was a loner. He lived very close to us. He lived in Brixton. He lived in Railton Road in Brixton. Yeah. He was the opposite in every physical sense to Andrew Wakefield. So Andrew Wakefield is about 6'2", 6'4". I can't quite remember how tall he is, but he's a very tall man. He's very softly spoken. He is, he's full of empathy. Brian Deer is about 5'7". He's a grey man. He's not warm in any way. He boasted, I think, about Justin Fashion, who committed suicide after he was exposed as a gay football player. And Brian Deer had a hand in that story. And he was, you know, he thought this was quite something that Justin Fashion, who committed suicide. You know, he was quite proud of that, I think.
Right.
And when we were at the GMC to listen to the hearing, the press room was packed and Brian Deer was in that press room and there was not a single journalist who met his eyes. No one. You know, he had just succeeded in getting this terrible doctor struck off and no one wanted to engage with him. And I remember sitting there thinking, that's interesting. You know, why are they kind of almost giving him the cold shoulder? I didn't really understand.
These are kind of health correspondents.
Yeah, this was all the national press. Obviously, it was a huge story. It was the longest and most expensive GMC hearing in British history. Andrew Wakefield and John Walker Smith. So there were three doctors on trial there. Two of them were struck off. John Walker Smith, one was cleared. John Walker Smith appealed later on, and I wrote down some words that Mr. Justice Mitting used to describe the way that Professor John Walker Smith had been struck off, and he cleared him, and he said, there were universal inadequacies, insufficient evidence, Laconic was a word used, fundamental errors, inadequate, distorted summary of evidence, factually unsound, flawed, perverse. I mean, it goes on so and on, James.
What was his role in the hearing?
There were 13 authors for this paper that was published in the Lancet.
Yeah.
All 13 authors were asked to retract the interpretation that their paper had said the MMR could cause autism. They'd never said that. It wasn't in the paper. It was an interpretation that the media had made, and kind of rightly, you know, they asked the right question, can the MMR cause autism? Wakefield and a cohort suspected it could, but they didn't have the evidence, so they were cautious. They said, We didn't conclusively prove that the MMR could cause autism, but we would like to make, we would like to investigate further. So they were asked to retract that interpretation. They said, well, we never made that interpretation. We are not going to retract it. So the three of them found themselves in front of the GMC. John Walker Smith, Professor John Walker Smith, was the most senior, and the lead author, I think, on the paper. Wakefield or Walker Smith were the lead authors. And they said, no, we're not going to, because we never said that.
Right.
And they found themselves up in front of the GMC.
Well, I think that's hire that lady, hire that journalist. Very good summary of the whole saga from start to finish, right from the introduction of these jabs back in the 1960s, as to what on earth happened to go so horribly wrong with the MMR jab. And then also the doctor who at the Royal Free, who was saying we're doing this all wrong, took on the pharmaceutical industry single-handed, well, it wasn't quite single-handedly, is just ejected from the system, Martin. The whole system says, no, we don't want someone in the system who's going to protect patients. We've got a lot of money to make here.
I hear what was said there.
Sally Beck, by the way, yeah. Sally Beck on the Delling Pod, which is a brilliant podcast. I think he's from, Daily Telegraph columnist, I think, something like that. Malvern College he was from, I seem to remember, James Delling Pod. Fantastic job he does, week after week after week. Let's get these people up on the mainstream press, please, and get rid of some of these idiots that just parrot everything they're told in a press release from Pfizer.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hear all of this. And I still, if we're talking about Pfizer and biological warfare, is that there is a massive biological warfare program going on in the world. The Iranian General Staff and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps have said, we think that that COVID was a biological warfare attack on us. And because we think that the strain of COVID, which was in Iran, was different from the one in Wuhan, and it attacked mostly our elite rather than, you know, people working in ports or stuff of that sort. Things are going to get a lot worse because we're on a downward trajectory.
Well, we're not. The Russians are coming to save us.
Not in the short run.
Okay. Presenter Neil Oliver, that's right, that's who I was trying to think of, he has been saying quite a lot about this on GB News, and talking about this, because that's why we've started part two with a whole theme on health, and really just pointing out how absolutely appalling and disgusting the World Health Organization has been. As you heard in the first hour, the guy from the WHO talking about forcibly separating families, all this sort of thing, and we've got to do it in a nice way, and how that's going to be. You know, this is what they were doing. Of course, they didn't need to do any of that if they'd only have used things like chloroquine, which Trump was lambasted for suggesting, and ivermectin and other drugs which could be used to treat COVID. But no, we were given these protocols which ended up killing many, many people, you know, tens of thousands, according to Tess Laurie here in the UK. These lives would have been saved if they hadn't been given instructions around the country to follow these World Health Organization protocols and Department for Health protocols, which were not treating the disease. They were mistreating the disease and ending up with treating it as if it was pneumonia, which it clearly wasn't. It was much much more like a SARS, as is in the clue, is in the title, SARS-CoV-2. As a result of all of that, we've now got this World Health Organization treaty coming chugging down the tracks towards us, and it was dealt with by Neil Oliver on GB News earlier this week.
Let us remember that for the past 2 years, the WHO has loudly celebrated the approach taken by China to the handling of COVID-19. Even now, as tens or perhaps hundreds of millions of Chinese citizens remain locked in their homes in scores of cities across that country, and after unknown numbers have died in those circumstances, including some who committed suicide by leaping to their deaths from their tower block imprisonment, the WHO continues to applaud the tactics of the Chinese Communist Party that is its benefactor. For his own part, Bill Gates, who struggles even to control viruses in the software sold by Microsoft, is on record admiring the draconian approach taken by Australia, to the extent that he has said that, in his opinion, the world would have had greater success in eliminating the disease, the one that more than likely leaked from a lab in China, if only more nations had followed the Australian model, locked everyone down and sought zero COVID. Now we in Great Britain, without so much as a by your leave from our leaders, and along with around 95% of the world's population, must contemplate a future in which decisions about what we will be ordered to do in the face of another pandemic will be taken by the unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats of the Chinese Communist Party worshipping WHO under the unseemly influence of a tech billionaire with no more qualifications in the fields of medicine and disease control than I have. It's worth remembering that President Donald Trump insisted on divorce from the WHO on the grounds that it was too close to China, only for President Biden to remarry them again in 2021. All of that is history, however. In a matter of days, the World Health Assembly will meet in Geneva for a vote on the treaty. The target date for final ratification is in May 2024, but by then the power grab will have long been completed. Amendments written into the proposed treaty by the re-enamoured Biden administration will see 194 nations cede sovereignty over national healthcare decisions to the WHO. The WHO would thereby have decision-making power over and above our own government and every other government. Consider this. When you watch footage of the 26 million people of Shanghai locked down in their homes, their cats and dogs beaten to death in the street, the WHO would, by the terms of the new treaty, have the power to impose the same on cities here. Know too that under the terms of the treaty, the WHO does not have to show any data to legitimise its conclusions or decisions. It's also worth knowing, to say the least, that it would be up to the WHO to define what the next pandemic is.
Well, it's interesting that the Russians are talking about leaving the WHO. I don't know if you're aware of that, Tony. They're going to leave the International Monetary Fund as well. They're going to leave the World Bank. The WHO is...
I think they're also talking about leaving the International Athletics Federation.
Well, indeed.
Many of these international bodies, yeah, of all sorts, actually.
Yes, because they're controlled by their enemies.
And not least of which, of course, is the International Criminal Court.
Well, yes, which was not controlled by the US because they're not a part of it.
Did you notice there was a prosecution there of some African leader again this week, mm-hmm, and various people around the world murmuring, well, still no Bushes, still no Blairs?
Well, of course not. Now, the point I would make is this, that there isn't a global conspiracy behind the WHO. Neil Oliver going on there about the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party, or the Communist Party of China, to give it its official title, is actually aware that COVID-19 is a biological warfare attack. This is what I've been stressing week after week on this show. And it may well be that the pharmaceutical companies in the West are also profiteering and killing people.
But they're not saying that, Martin. Are you channeling them through telepathy?
No, I'm just pointing out that the Chinese Communist Party, or the Communist Party of China, to give it its proper name, feels they are at war, which is why they've adopted the measures they've adopted. Neil Oliver still thinks COVID came from bats, or if it leaked from the Wuhan...
No, he's not saying
that.
Oh, he's
saying it leaked from the Wuhan lab. The Wuhan lab was funded by DARPA, just like these biological warfare labs in the Ukraine. The world is at war. The Iranian government are well aware that they were attacked by the West using COVID-19. And they've had lockdowns, and they've had They've used the Chinese Sinopharm vaccine. Not the, they said they weren't going to be allowed to have any vaccines at all by the West because they're under sanctions. And they said, well, we don't want your vaccines anyway. So because we think they're going to kill us.
Are you admitting now that maybe these measures in China are war preparation measures rather than just a response to the virus?
The virus itself is an act of war. And the measures they have adopted is because they perceive it to be an act of war. And going forward, I'm afraid, there's going to be more acts of war. And countries will make decisions on the basis of their circumstances to defend themselves. In Iran, they had lockdowns, Tony. They did, because they knew they were under attack. That was their perception.
The thing this does remind me about is the fact that the Chinese government is actually far, far better prepared for a nuclear war, never mind a biological war, than we are.
Yes, but the point is there's not much point preparing for a nuclear war because you'll die in it. The idea that you are going to survive it is wrong.
No, well, I think you're totally wrong. Because I totally disagree with you, Tony. They have decided that their population is going to be underground. If there's a nuclear war, they're going to provide bunkers for their people in the bottom of every large tower block, in every major conurbation, and it even, as we were hearing a few weeks ago, in shopping centres, things like that. They make sure that they have a provision for it, like we used to do, by the way, here in the 1950s and 60s.
And it was pointless. And if the Chinese...
Well, it was pointless because there was no nuclear war.
No, it's pointless. If there is a nuclear war, you won't survive in a bunker.
Well,
who's
to say?
No, Tony, we've been talking about how dangerous nuclear weapons were earlier.
Okay, so it's not...
Why do you think going into a bunker is going to protect you from a nuclear war? It isn't. The point is to avoid
Of course it's going to protect you. If it's a hardened bunker built by the Chinese Communist Party and they've decided that they're going to protect their people, feed them and make sure they've got plenty of water, then it will protect you to a certain extent. It might not be all roses once you come out, but at least that there's some measures been taken to stop people dying. That's at least what the Chinese government have done.
Well, it may well be if there's a conventional war, which there may well be, then going to bunkers makes sense. And, of course, it may well be that we will have a big conventional war, in which case you do need to take cover in bunkers, and you might have to have lockdowns and all sorts.
You're quite irking me here, that the idea that a nuclear bunker, which may have anything up to a mile of concrete between you and the nuclear bomb, which may anyway be many miles away, is not going to protect people. Of course it's going to protect people.
Nuclear winter will kill everybody in the Northern Hemisphere.
Not necessarily.
Oh, come on, Tony. Here are you going about the dangers of nuclear power earlier on, and now you're saying you're going to survive a nuclear war?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is if you've got bunkers and things like that, then you're much more likely to be able to survive it. They've taken some measures. Nuclear winter is not going to kill everybody. It's going to kill lots of people nearer the poles. It won't kill so many people near the equator. And, of course, there'll be a massive struggle for food. We've actually been into this, but it's not going to kill everybody on the planet Earth. It's going to kill a hell of a lot of people, possibly billions, even trillions of people. But at least the Chinese, for the benefit of their own population, are taking measures. We seem to be taking none.
If we started digging nuclear bunkers, Tony, that means we're going to war with Russia and China. And I would say this, if we're going to war with Russia and China, I want to go to war with my government. I'm fed up of this. Really fed up with everything that's been happening. It's time for people to wake up. We are under attack by the deep state in the West, not by the Communist Party of China, not by the Russians, by our own government.
As I said earlier, the Russians are now taking that deep state in the West on, aren't they?
They are indeed. And one of the things they're doing, or thinking of doing, is withdrawing from the World Health Organization. So it clearly isn't a puppet. They regard it as a hostile organization, and it may well be that the Chinese will withdraw from it for the same kinds of reason. We are actually at a turning point, a most important turning point in modern history since 1945.
Well, Michael Hudson
and lots of people are already dead, and the war's going to get worse.
Michael Hudson agrees with you, and we'll be hearing from him in a little while. But before that, we will hear part two of Neil Oliver. I've discovered, I didn't realise he was doing this, but Neil, who does his piece on GB News and does that within his Ofcom rules, etc., has also got his own little channel where he sometimes puts little pieces up where he adds to what he feels able and right to say on GB News in the TV media, I suppose, or whatever you call it. It's out on Freeview and various other channels. And here is Neil Oliver now on his own little channel saying, who pulls the strings about the pandemic treaty, wealth and power?
We're seeing the rise of a new dominance. And it's the dominance of billionaires, and it'll only be a matter of time before it's trillionaires. And I'm just not sure how appropriate that I think that is. And that they seek to legitimise that power by the application of or the exploitation of the notion of philanthropy. I'm not sure that's good enough. St. Augustine, one of the father figures of early Christianity, St. Augustine of Hippo, he had a particularly good line which is oft quoted, "Charity is no substitute for justice withheld." Charity is no substitute for justice withheld. So in the case of someone like Bill Gates manoeuvring for a controlling position with the World Health Organization, which is simultaneously seeking to overrule the sovereign rights of 194 nations so that it, an unelected body, would have the power to dictate to us about lockdown and mandated vaccines, that one individual, Bill Gates, is in a position, a dominating position within that organisation, I say is something that at the very least we ought to be keeping an eye on. And just because he does it all in the guise of philanthropy is not good enough. No matter his philanthropy, he has grown much richer than he ever was in the last few years. You know, his wealth began with Microsoft, but his status as one of the richest people on the planet is a much more recent manifestation of what you can do. If you've got some money, you can get a lot more money. Bill Gates is a classic example of that. And we need to be really careful about keeping an eye on these individuals. And philanthropy is not a good enough cover for what they might be doing. Bill Gates says that the return, the profit return on vaccines is the best that he knows about. He stands to make money from pushing vaccines. And now he's hand in glove with the World Health Organization that is seeking to have a controlling position over governmental decisions about lockdowns and mandates and the rest of it in 194 sovereign countries. We've got to watch this before it goes any further.
So there's Neil Oliver there on his own little channel saying things, I suppose he feels like he can't really say on GB News. But, you know, he's right, isn't he? This is an oligarchy trying to take over.
Yeah, well, in that case, I've got no problem with that analysis. But I think what will happen as we go further into World War III is that governments will, of course, control their own situation. They won't be giving any power to supranational bodies like the WHO. The Communist Party of China is not going to let the WHO tell them what to do. The Russians are talking about withdrawing from the WHO because they don't think it's doing the right job. In other words, the idea that they're going to create a WHO which will then tell sovereign countries what to do, it ain't going to be the case. The Iranians aren't going to take any notice of what they say because they're at war. And if, when countries are at war, they don't, in fact, give their powers to supranational bodies. Supranational bodies often get destroyed.
What did you make this week, talking of the war, of George Bush Jr., George W. is making this so-called gaffe in a speech? It just looked, you know, did you see that about...
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so, I mean, it looked to me as if the whole thing was staged. You know, he's not very good at acting, Bush. It looks
well,
like
he never was.
This is supposed to be a joke. Oh, an illegal war. You know, I'm just joking about the fact that I started an illegal war. This is a Skull and Bones guy from Yale University, along with his father and many other people from the Skull and Bones Society. You know, so anyway, let's have a little listen to George Bush now. So, and maybe, you know, anyone listening, you can make up your own mind. Is he acting here?
In contrast, Russian elections are rigged. Political opponents are imprisoned or otherwise eliminated from participating in the electoral process. The result is an absence of checks and balances in Russia and the decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq. I mean, of Ukraine. Iraq, anyway. 75.
That's George Bush Jr. Was it? I mean, it looked to me. It sounded to me staged a bit. Was it really a mistake, Martin? I think the idea is he's really just taking the Mickey, isn't he?
Well, when he was in office, he was well known for coming out with stupid stuff. So now he's got a bit older and a bit more dementia friendly. It's not surprising that he's still coming out with stupid stuff where he gets the word wrong. But it's basically Freudian slip, isn't it? He knows that it was an illegal invasion of Iraq. In fact, millions of people died, far more than have died in the Ukraine. But is anybody going to stand trial for that? Of course they're not. And of course, ultimately, these things aren't decided in court. They're decided on the battlefield.
We'll wind up the stuff on Ukraine now, but we're not allowed to hear RT. Of course, there are ways to find it, not least of which is on Odyssey. And I was watching the other day, recorded this, which is about information warfare. And this is the reason why the British government, Western governments, generally NATO governments, who seem to be running the show all over Europe and America these days, are blocking RT, because you're not able to hear their excellent critique of our disinformation campaigns all over the London media.
The Ukrainian Defense Ministry has published a video of its army claiming they've pushed back Russian forces at the border near Kharkov, the country's second largest city. But questions are being raised about the footage, as among other things, the soldiers are heard saying they came to the frontier on April 15th, but the video, for some reason, wasn't published until a full month later. Our correspondent Maria Finoshna told me more.
Most of Western media have been very quick to spread this news that Kyiv told them, and they were either not very professional, not very accurate with the information they were offered, or another guess is that maybe the idea was to make people believe that it was true that the Ukrainian forces reached the border with Russia in Kharkiv region, pushing the Russian troops back. It doesn't matter, I mean, how close to reality it was, and it seems that it wasn't quite close to things on the ground. First of all, the dates. Indeed, the footage was released on May 15th, but the soldiers in the footage, or whoever they are, maybe the actors, they say April. Let's take a listen. I have to explain why I call them actors, because later another video was published showing the same group of people in military uniform carrying, you can see it right now on the screen, carrying the frontier post, the same blue and yellow border post that these people are gathered around in the footage.
So that's astonishing, isn't it? Because you can understand for morale reasons doing that, but actually taping it, that footage of them lifting it through what seems to be a forest, that's surely a giveaway.
Yeah, thank God someone decided to film it so that now we can see that they were carrying this post to the filming position.
Right.
They were choosing it. So it shows that it's not a real case and it's not a real frontier and this whole thing was not true.
So, obviously they've got a border post in their hands, but it's not actually a border post. This is pure propaganda. The other thing that she talks about, various things there, which include filming troops that are actually got paintball guns. They haven't got real guns, but unless you're a real aficionado on paintball, you'd never know. And that is put out all on the Western press as if they're real soldiers.
Well, what's happening is that the Western press and media and BBC, etc., are regurgitating Ukrainian claims about the war and every aspect of it as if they were true, straight away. No question, the Ukrainians, the brave Ukrainians are doing this, the brave Ukrainians are doing that, the brave Ukrainians are doing the other. I mean, look at the way in which they've talked about the surrender at Azovstal this week. They've talked about it, the Ukrainians said it, I heard it on the BBC News, that it's not a surrender, it's an evacuation. According to orders. So Zelensky has ordered them to evacuate to Russian prison camps, a bit like the British military ordered their troops to evacuate to build the Burma Railway. It's ridiculous. And if people can't see why that use of language is inappropriate, if they're surrendering, they're not being evacuated.
I think if you're looking on the TV, folks, you can quite often find the Azov Battalion's logo burnt
into the
footage we're watching. Footage. This is what.
That's right.
What
the Azov Battalion's logo is related to the Waffen-SS Galicia Division, because during this World War II, the Waffen-SS recruited Western Ukrainians, Galicians, Ruthenian speakers, and the Azov Battalion are made up of those kind of people.
One of the clips.
But they're not from East Ukraine.
One of the clips I was watching this week, it said it was the destruction of a Russian command post. Well, by a missile. Well, no missile went in. There were a whole load of bombs that had been placed in this building. And I wondered, well, how can you go into a Russian command post and place bombs in there? Aren't the Russians going to have something to say about that if you do that? Secondly, there was no act. Nobody ran away. There was nobody. Didn't seem to be anyone near. It seemed like an empty building. And the only evidence that it had anything to do with the military is that they had a little bit of film of one of a look like an army truck driving past, which didn't even stop there. So this is the stuff which we're being fed now. Anyway, time to go to Michael Hudson, because he's got some very interesting things to say about the economic side of this war.
As we're seeing now, the world is dividing into two parts. We can see that in the fight against Russia, which is also a fight against China and against India, as you noted, and it seems Indonesia and other countries as well. The United States is pushing a world that can be controlled by American investors, that the ideal of the American neoliberal plan is to do to other countries what it did to Russia after 1991. Take all of your public domain, your oil companies, your nickel mines, your electric utilities, give them all to the a wealthy oligarchy that can only make money once it's taken control of these companies by selling the stocks to the West. The West will buy out oil, just like Michael Khodorkovsky tried to sell Yukos oil to Standard Oil in the West. And we've got to put an oligarchy that will sell all of the national domain, all of the patrimony in natural resources and all the companies to American investors on the cheap. The Russian stock market led all the stock markets in the world from 1994 up to about 1998. This was a huge ripoff. The United States wants to be able to do that to the rest of the world. And it was furious when Russia said, we've lost more population as a result of neoliberalism than we did in all of World War II fighting against Nazism. We've got to stop. And Russia began to say, we've got to use Russia's population and industry and natural resources for Russia's benefit, not for the United States' benefit. Well, the United States was absolutely furious with this, and the fury has erupted in the NATO war against Russia in the last few months and what's ongoing now. And the United States says, well, U.S. State Department officials have said, what we want to do is carve up Russia into maybe four different countries, Siberia, Western Russia, Southern Russia near Central Asia, maybe Northern Russia. And once we've done that, we cut Russia off from China. Then we go into China. We finance, we send the ISIS and the Al-Qaeda into the Uyghur areas, the Muslim areas, and we start a color revolution there. And then we break up China into a northern part, the southern part, the central part. And once we break them up, we can more or less control them, and we can then come in, buy up their resources, and take over their industry, their labor, and their government, and get richer to obtain from China, Russia, India, Indonesia, and Iran the wealth that we're no longer producing in the United States now that we've deindustrialized. So that is, the world is dividing into two parts. And the one part is not simply the United States and its European satellites on the one hand versus the non-white population on the other hand. It's finance capitalism versus the rest of the world, which is protecting itself by socialism, which in many ways fulfills what was the ideal of industrial capitalism during the 19th century, when industrial capitalism was actually progressive. And it was progressive. That's part of the whole theme of my book. It was revolutionary. It tried to free economies from the legacy of feudalism, from the legacy of hereditary landlords. And now the financial class is no longer the landlord class, but the financial class. And the landlord class pays most of its rent to the financial class in the form of mortgage interest, as it borrows money to buy property and housing and commercial sites on credit. And you have the kind of financialization that has increased housing prices in the United States to over 40% of income that is officially guaranteed for mortgages, that has priced American labor out of the market, privatized healthcare, 18% of GDP. That's pricing America out of the world market. Debt for car, auto debt, student debt, which in other countries, education is free. That's pricing America out of the market. So you have a basically uncompetitive economy that's committing financial suicide following the same dynamic that destroyed the Roman Empire, where an oligarch, predatory oligarchy took over and maintained power by an assassination policy of its critics, just very similar to what America's been doing in Latin America and other countries. So right now, for the first time, you have a critical mass, and you have the ability of China, Iran, Russia, India, other countries together to be self-sufficient. They don't need relations with the United States. They can handle their own, they can create their own monetary system outside of the International Monetary Fund, which is basically an arm of the Defense Department. They can give loans to build up the infrastructure of countries outside of the World Bank, which is basically an arm of the Defense Department, the deep state. So you have the American economy, essentially a merger between the military-industrial complex and the Wall Street financial fire sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, is a way that really cannot develop any more than the Roman Empire could develop by trying to obtain militarily what it could not produce at home anymore. Well, China and other countries, now that they have their industrial base, the raw materials, the food ability to feed themselves, the agriculture, and the technology, they can go their own way. And so we're seeing in the last few months the beginning of a war that's going to go on for, I think, 20 years, maybe 30 or 40 years. The world is splitting away, and it won't be a pretty sight because the United States and its European satellites are trying to fight to prevent an inevitable breakaway that it cannot prevent any more than Europe's landlord class could prevent industrial capitalism from developing in the 19th century.
Well, yeah, I read that. I read a transcript of that article, that entry earlier in the week. And, of course, he's got a new book out called Financialization, Industrial Capitalism and Socialism. It's a masterful analysis. And, of course, he's a visiting professor in Beijing University and many universities in China. They take him very seriously. And I believe he knows Sergei Glazyev, who's the leading economist in Russia, who's now developing this alternative currency with the Chinese, which will ultimately dethrone the dollar as the world's reserve currency.
He's talking about basically the whole planet dividing basically into people who are going to go along with this and those that aren't, really. He's talking about a very dualistic world that's being created. I suppose that's perfect if you wanted to start a world war. That's exactly what you need. In fact, it's exactly what Mark Sloboda was saying on this show about, was it 6 weeks ago? He called it the great decoupling. He's saying it's never coming back together, and basically the world is splitting.
Yeah, well, I think there will be two blocks, as has been suggested. But what will happen is that the Western bloc will collapse quicker than people think. Don't forget that the policies that are now being pursued, individual European companies and countries have already decided that they're going to pay for oil and gas in rubles because they can't do anything else. Now, if they do try not to do so, but in any case, whatever they do, really, I think the European economies are now about to crash. People are used to a certain standard of living.
Martin, you're always talking about crashes. You have ever since we started this show back in 2008, actually.
Yes.
But it will only crash, surely, once the financial institutions and the oligarchs are not coining it from us. At the moment, there's a situation here in the UK and in many other countries where the poor are being taxed, the rich are not, and so wealth is just flowing from the poor to the rich. And until that stops, surely there's no point in them crashing the economy.
No, but it's not a question of whether they want to crash the economy. It's a question of whether it's going to crash. And of course, the problem with capitalism as a whole is that it's not a planned system. Everybody, it's devil take the hindmost. And of course, there is no strategy. That I think what's been very clear and most important of all in the last few weeks is that the ruble has become the best performing currency in the international currency
Those sanctions didn't work too well then.
No,
did
they didn't. And of course, that is the strategy. They thought they were going to crash the Russian economy.
Did they?
I think they did.
They pretended to the people who backed them, like no. Liz Truss. Liz Truss believed it.
Yes, well, yeah, but Liz Truss is a very low-level person. She may very well believe it, but it doesn't mean that she's in charge or that she knows what's going on.
Well, she signs these things off.
What's actually happening is politicians who've got very little background in understanding international macroeconomics are falling over each other to demand more sanctions on Russia, more weaponry for the Ukraine. And it's not because they've got either a war-fighting strategy or an economic strategy. It's just that everybody's got to be seen to be outdoing the others in demanding more stupid policies.
It's groupthink.
It is groupthink. And, of course, what will happen is it's quite likely, the way I see it now, that the Western European economy is going to crash. Things like Deutsche Bank will go down. And as Deutsche Bank goes down, because it's an international bank, it'll take down the United States. But living on the other side of the world, China and Russia, by cooperating, may not even have a recession.
Okay, so can you remind us of Michael Hudson's new book's title? I've not seen
that. I think it's called, off the top of my head, Financialization, Industrial Capitalism and Socialism. But if you go to his website, he's advertising
one of the best groundings in economics from him, and it's good. I mean, you who did PPE, politics, philosophy and economics, recommend him, because I mean the thing is, he's not only is he very very knowledgeable, but he's also extremely articulate too. Two great combinations, good old Michael. But anyway, Killing the Host is one of his books. Another one is called
Super Imperialism
is another one. Killing the Host is great, isn't it? I mean, that's exactly, of course, what the financial system is doing to us right this minute. Yeah. Out there. J is for Junk Economics, an A to Z guide of reality and fiction in economics. That sounds great. I don't know if they... do you think that the Hudson is taught in, the major universities, Oxford, etc.?
No. Days? Well, he's... In academia in the US, he's an emeritus professor at Kansas University, I believe. I mean, when Super Imperialism came out in 1972, he'd nailed his colours to the mast as basically a critic of capitalism and so on. And he thought, well, certain jobs will never be open to me. And guess what? He was employed by the Pentagon to teach future generals about how super imperialism works.
Isn't that interesting? So they know
how to rip the world.
They know
off.
It's rubbish. So they're employing someone that agree. In a way, this is very, very similar.
Really like the book, Michael. Come and tell us
what
you're
saying. Is very similar to Dr. Chris Busby, we heard from earlier, the nuclear low-level radiation scientist. In part of that interview, which I put up on our show page last week at thisweek.org.uk. He says, actually, what's happening, he's getting more and more requests for papers because scientists around the world are taking this more and more seriously, his analysis, that the nuclear industry has been conning people for decades about how dangerous it is.
Yes, well, but I mean, obviously, in the terms of economics, is more ideological than, I mean, everything's ideological, obviously. But I think the interesting thing is that Hudson, as a US economist, is so widely respected in places like China and Russia. And I think that is the future. We're not going to have, ultimately, there will not be two systems. There will be a one global system, but it won't be based on the Western model. The Western model has served its time. It's going to have to go.
Before we finish, Martin, can I just push you one more time on this whole idea of a long-term conspiracy? The theory that Albert Pike, the Grand Master of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry in the United States, communicating with Giuseppe Mazzini over in Italy, said that what we need is these three world wars, culminating in a massive conflagration between the Zionists and Islam in the Middle East in order to discredit the monotheistic faiths and bring in a pantheistic state. That's what he said back in, I'm paraphrasing, back in 1871, apparently. You don't think that's at all possible, because we're going to hear our final clip is going to be for the first time. I've played this clip a couple of times in the past, but never giving the right name. I finally found out the guy's actually name is C. Walter Veith, V-E-I-T-H, that's speaking now. And I feel like, because I've given the wrong name, that someone had put up on the internet the wrong name, and I managed to track it down the correct name. So what do you make of this whole theory about this enormous kind of long-term conspiracy in order to create world wars?
Conspiracies exist, but being able to predict the future is rather more complex than people imagine. And you can do it, but it's not based upon throwing dice.
Well, the other thing about if you're working to a plan that was drawn up in 1871, things may not be quite as you seem in 2022.
You can imagine that the military commanders in the Ukraine, whatever side they're on at the moment, everything that can go wrong will go wrong.
Well, I just also want to say when I first heard about this, I mean, I'd seen bits and pieces about it, but I actually heard from a friend of mine who worked with years ago, and she had been living with the Bedouin for several years and got to speak Arabic, etc. And she said, this is one of the Bedouin's great pet theories. Anyway, here we go with Walter Veith, our final item for tonight, talking about Albert Pike's letter to Mazzini, planning three world wars.
Now, Albert Pike wrote a letter to Mazzini, and that was dated August 15, 1871, in which he propagated that there should be a world order, a one order where all nations are under the control of one central organization. And in order to achieve this, they plan the First World War, to overthrow the power of the Tsars in Russia, protector of orthodoxy, and bring about an atheistic communistic state. Did that happen? The Second World War, that's also written long before the event, to originate between Great Britain and Germany, to strengthen communism as antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture, and bring about a Zionist state in Israel. Did it achieve this objective? Yes. In fact, after this war, Israel, in its present form, was reinstated under the protection of Britain. And then, interestingly enough, a Third World War, a Middle Eastern war involving Judaism and Islam and spreading internationally. Well, here's another quote, just in case people don't like that quote. Mazzini with Pike developed a plan for three world wars so that eventually every nation would be willing to surrender its national sovereignty to a world government. The first war was to end the Tsarist regime in Russia, the second to allow the Soviet Union to control Europe, the third world war was to be in the Middle East between Muslim and Jews and would result in Armageddon. Interesting. Now, how were they going to do it? Let's read what Albert Pike wrote about these wars and how they were going to be unleashed. He wrote, quote, "We shall unleash the nihilist and the atheist," so the destroyer and the atheist, "and we will provoke a formidable social cataclysm which in its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism, origin of savagery and the most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere the citizens obliged to defend themselves against the minority of revolutionaries will exterminate these destroyers of civilization, and the multitude, disillusioned with Christianity, will receive the pure light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer. The destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." Wow, what a clever plan. So you rub the two systems which you create up against the other, you create atheism as an antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture, you have these two clash until they rub each other up, and then out of that you will get a new world order where you have a new religion which is far more esoteric and actually honors Satan. Isn't that a rather clever plan?
So that was C. Walter Veith, V-E-I-T-H, explaining for us all the wonderful plan to bring in power. Well, actually, ultimately, yes, the idea is to discredit any idea. I mean, by having Christian Zionists, Jewish Zionists, so-called Christian Zionists, so-called Jewish Zionists fighting away with the Islamic world, the idea is to create this kind of to discredit the whole monotheistic faiths and to bring in a pantheistic society. That's a fascinating plan. This is, of course, what the Scottish Rite Freemasonry Ordo Ab Caio is their motto. It looks to me certainly as if it fits everything pretty much as to what we see going on in our world today. The only problem, of course, as I said before we heard the clip, is this is a very old plan. Will it work? Well, we shall certainly see. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, Lib Dem councillor for Brissington West, Andrew Varney, and also to our sound engineer, Dave Bazenko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews, story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which has got my email address, etc. on there, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk if you like. Just one note about Radio 4 All. Anyone that's been having trouble listening on Radio 4 All, because we've had several, well, quite, I've had probably a dozen or so reports of people saying they're listening on the Radio 4 All site itself without downloading the MP3 first, and that the sound has been cutting out and it's been resetting. So if you've got any of that experience of that, please do write it up, take some screenshots and email it to me, and I can share it with the technical team who are working on the new site, which went up about 3 weeks ago, which they're still having quite a lot of teething troubles with at the Radio 4 All. So please don't just scream at your computer. Email me and I can send it to the people who could do something about it. My paperback's about deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle for Arnhem. That one costs £15. Also, my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, the Siege of Heaven reader there on eBay, and the Siege of Heaven ebook, and links to all of them via www.bilderberg.org. This mysterious organisation seems to have vanished into thin air, or maybe they're just running the whole show. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, where you'll also hear Sputnik, the English language Russian service, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen show and over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioqk.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings, because sometimes these things just disappear. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own too many of our transmitters and printing presses, that glorious Fourth Reich. So, which I write about in the Siege, in the Traitors of Arnhem book, the Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. See you down at Burford for Levellers Day tomorrow if you're around Oxfordshire. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, back to the regular time at 5 o'clock every Friday now. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.